All right, everybody, it's 9:30. Good morning. This is the Wednesday, August 12, 2020 morning session of the Portland City Council. Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Here.
Udaly?
She's muted. She's here. There she is.
Fritz?
Here.
Wheeler?
I am here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely or by video and teleconference. And the City has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the City's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and Channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to the council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you to everybody for your patience, your flexibility, your understanding, your resilience, as we manage through this challenging situation to do the city's business. Before we jump into the business, I want to start today by thanking Loretta Smith and Dan Ryan for both running for the city council seat that was previously held by our colleague and friend Nick Fish. I want to congratulate Dan Ryan. It looks as though this morning people are calling the race in his favor. And I just wanted to say to Dan how much we all look forward to having him as a colleague on the council once the vote tally is certified by the city's auditor, which I'm told should happen within the next several weeks. Apparently by the end of the first week in September is what people are suggesting, September 9th as the target date. But don't hold me to that. At any rate, congratulations, Dan, and welcome aboard. Carla, with that, we'll start this morning with communications.
Do you want the city attorney to read the council rules?
Yeah, thank you. I apologize for that. If we could please hear from our very capable and able city attorney on the rules of order and decorum for the city council.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony today should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Lindley. And with that, Carla, communications is first up.
Item 649, request of Marsha Joslin to address council regarding the climate of the city.
Good morning. Let's see. Marsha, are you on? Are you unmuted? Carla, do you see her on
the list? I'm not seeing her. I'm sorry. Did you know she signed in, Gayla, this morning?
No, I haven't seen Marsha sign in yet.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Next is 650, request of Elizabeth Nathan to address council regarding fundamental police reform.
Good morning.
Hi, so this is actually Jennifer Perot. Elizabeth Nathan asked that I fill in for her and read her statement. She had a last minute family emergency.
And I worked. Under those circumstances, I'll allow it. Thank you.
I really appreciate that. I am a small business owner. Elizabeth and I worked together with other local businesses to support the protests and the Black Lives Matter movement. In June, we circulated the petition titled Small Business Owners Demand Mayor Ted Wheeler to Fund the Police, which now has 6,000 signatures by owners of businesses in the city. I want to be quick, but I really want to make the point that despite several media stories to the contrary and some really garbage statistics from the Portland Business Alliance, the vast majority of small businesses, at least in our networks, support the protests and desire big fundamental change to policing. I really want to refer to Maureen Bachman's statement as the president of Kenton's Neighborhood Association regarding property damage sustained in Kenton Business District the other night. I quote, "Our human-owned small businesses were unscathed. The minimal property damage is fixable and replaceable. What is not replaceable is the human lives, the Black lives lost to police brutality in our country. 70 plus days into this, and PPB has refused to come to the table to discuss a path forward. I know not everyone agrees with tactics, but I can't condemn tactics I may not like. The reality is more in our community were radicalized last night watching PPB kettle and beat our neighbors and community with impunity. And that's a success. Why PPB decided corralling folks into a contained plaza in a neighborhood with no escape raises a lot of questions. I am determined to ask these questions and demand answer. It felt staged by PPB, and an unemotional viewing of the damage, it appears defensive rather than destructive on the part of the protesters. I'd also like to point out that folks that were in the protest last night came together today to raise over $4,000 for the restoration of the plaza. This is our community too. Let's not forget that ever. We are more alike than apart, and ultimately Black Lives Matter. All this is to say, and this is me speaking out, that a large number of small business owners believe deeply in this movement, and we understand that it may come at an occasional cost to us, but we have enough faith in this project and in our communities to recover, and that there is no financial cost that could possibly outweigh that of another innocent Black life. And so we want the protests to continue until the demands of the movement are met. We see batons swinging at justifiably angry young people. We see arrested people on the ground getting face punched by large men in riot gear. We see our Black leader, Demetri Hester, getting arrested. And then we see you talking about property damage. We ask that you stop invoking small businesses in this false narrative that the protests are violent and somehow in contradiction with the movement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is 651, request of Richard Carson to address council regarding the cultural pandemic. He contacted us and will not be speaking.
All right, thank you, Carla. Mm-hmm.
652, request of Richard Rubin to address council regarding begin proactive full community involved preparations for the winter needs of the homeless population.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay. Now is a streak of warm, dry, and sunny days, but in a few short months, we all know that will change. Huge added stress is seasonally placed on both the homeless and organizations providing basic survival services. Add the likely condition of continuing suggested or mandated violence-related restrictions on spaces and groups, small and certainly large. Limits will continue on both public, the library system, community centers, the MAX, and private nonprofit, such as social service providers, facilities. This will extremely affect both our daytime and nighttime ability to fulfill and not obstruct the fundamental physical, mental, and emotional needs of a growing population, needs that are basic human rights. Active pathways to heal this, at least the will of our country, society, and localities to do so, were always questionable. Now even that, like all of us, is under a huge new stress. I am therefore requesting the urgent organization of a, quotes, Places for Me, Not the Virus project, with the involvement and participation of both the usual actors in homeless matters, the city, county, and service providers and Fresh Minds and Voices, entities, and participants from wherever they can be found. It will be necessary to access both new ideas and approaches and probably new actors and facilities to offer even basic life support, and we should aim higher than that. This means first addressing the absolute need for stable, safe, private spaces to sleep and maintain important possessions. In other words, if there is inadequate planning and support, then no more tent evictions. then dry, warm daytime spaces for eating, socializing, work, study, charging devices, and leisure. Services to those with special needs must also continue. This will be a huge challenge requiring rapid and creative thinking and energy, and perhaps some unwritten rule breaking and upward demands. Hint, FEMA and the National Guard have very useful facilities and equipment. I'm sure the city does as well. There's probably more hidden. The state must support, the feds don't care, and there is space available for stable or at least seasonally stable accommodations. That was my statement.
Thank you. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
653, request of Shannon Hiller Webb to address council regarding an update to ordinance number 190044 for grant agreements to support neighborhood associations.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dear Mayor and City Council members, my name is Shannon Hiller-Webb, and I appeared before you on July 9th with 19 other concerned residents with prepared testimony, accompanying PowerPoint, and video to speak to our concerns in regards to Southwest Neighborhoods, Inc. Coalition, otherwise known as SWNY. We appreciate the Council's vote on July 9th to withhold funding from SWNY pending a forensic audit, and we applaud the step taken for oversight and accountability. However, a request was made that we not provide public testimony at that time, and instead each council member and the mayor offered to have a private audience with all of us. We were concerned at that time about the difficulty in assembling 20 people multiple times to share our message, but agreed to do our best. I'm happy to share that several of us were able to meet with Commissioners Hardesty and Udaly, and we appreciate your time and attention to the many complex issues presented by SWNY. We have reached out multiple times to Commissioner Fritz with no response and have been unsuccessful in securing a time to meet with Mayor Wheeler. We recognize Portland is reeling from the pandemic crisis and is a focus point of the Black Lives Matter movement, and these matters require great attention and time. It is with this in mind that the group of 20 of us decided to record our testimony on video so each of you can listen to our testimony at your convenience and fulfill the commitment that each of you made to learn about our concerns that should inform the work of the forensic audit at a minimum. We have worked tirelessly to pull this together after having worked equally hard to assemble before you on July 9th. It is our hope that you will remain true to your commitment and will watch this video in the very near future. It has been a month since we met, and there have been important changes worth noting, so the video does include new updates. For example, SWNY recently secured an attorney to represent them in regards to Civic Life's records request and forensic audit. As of today, President Leslie Hammond has refused to accept Civic Life's invitation to meet with the board and learn about the goals, timeline, and expectations for a transparent audit process. I will note that yesterday the secretary suggested they may reach out after August 26th to set up a meeting. SWNY will have pushed their first meeting with the Civic Life for nearly 2 months after the audit was requested while SWNY was defunded. Civic Life is SWNY's primary funder, in addition to two smaller funders, and these funders in total comprise 85% of SWNY's operating budget. These two smaller funders are the Bureau of Environmental Services and West Multnomah Soil and Water, and both recently informed SWNY that they are removing their funding from SWNY. Our testimony can be viewed on YouTube at the following link in my testimony, and I'm entering it in as official public testimony. I have also provided the council clerk with a PowerPoint slide presentation with the video embedded for ease of record keeping. I thank you for your time, as always.
Shannon, thank you. And I look forward to watching that, and I appreciate it. I'm sorry we haven't been able to get a meeting up to this point, but I will view the video and the testimony, and I'm appreciative of your being here this morning.
Thank you.
Mayor, we have 649, Marcia Joslin.
Yeah, good. Go ahead, Marcia.
Good morning. Greetings, in God we trust, and in one nation under God. I wanted to reach out to Mayor Ted Wheeler and the council today because I am concerned about the climate in Portland and all of the protests and things that are taking place with Black Lives Matter. I have tried to reach you, Mayor Wheeler, for a year, so it is an honor to be before you and the council today and finally get an opportunity to speak on the conditions that I see. And I'm not only concerned about the outward systemic racism that the country has been outraged about, but I am concerned about structured racism, systemic racism, institutionalized systemic racism, interpersonal systemic racism, and interpersonalized systemic racism. And I want to be able to get an opportunity to meet in a personal setting to share some of my personal experiences. I have experienced, because of my complaint against law enforcement in your city, I have experienced just what the gentleman in Westland had experience, where police authorities had gotten with my job and tried to bring criminal charges or to set me up or frame me for a criminal case. And I'm concerned about this because there ought to be a platform where you can complain about law enforcement and not have to go through the things that you have to go through as Black people in society. I've also had many forms of corruptness at the hands of your city. My income tax were taken, and I believe that they were intentionally done, taken, because that would mean IRS was involved locally. That would mean that Cash Oregon would be involved locally, and the IRS advocates, and all of them would be illiterate on how taxes are done. And because I have a degree in accounting, I was able to catch them in
That's
trying
3 minutes.
To get money from me.
If you have a couple more points, go ahead and make them, Marcia.
I want to share this last. There has, my girlfriend's husband was killed over at 122nd and Division, and Mike Cribbs, who was over traffic, they had four lights at each intersection, and I asked them what those lights do because they have not caught the person who ran over him. But my concern, even more than that, they told, David Enns, the investigator, told my friends that they would be doing a Crime Stopper, which has never happened. And that is concerning to me, why they didn't do what they said they were going to do. And lastly, I am concerned about many different issues at the hands of law officers. Your DMV said that my license were suspended, and they approached me after 9.5 years, almost 10 years. And I had a valid license, and after having one because of my complaints, now all of a sudden I have an issue with my license. But hopefully I will get to speak with you in person and address these issues or come up with some type of overseeing that you can oversee your officers and make sure that Portland is a safe place for Black people within other areas and not just the outward police brutality, that your officers will have an accountability for slandering people's names and doing things to retaliate after there has been a complaint launched against them. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcia. Appreciate your being here today. Carla, on the consent agenda, has any item been pulled?
Yes, Mayor, we've had a request for 655.
655, please call the roll on the remainder of the consent.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye, the consent agenda is approved. 654, please, our one time certain item for today.
Amend the comprehensive plan map, zoning map, Title 33, Planning and Zoning, and Title 30, Affordable Housing, to revise the single dwelling residential designations and base zones.
Very good, colleagues. Today we take our final vote on the residential infill project. This is a project that has been with my administration throughout all 4 years of my administration, plus the year prior to that. So this has been going on for quite some time. Before we begin our substantive discussion on the residential infill program, I want to announce, as I always do, that I'm a renter in the zone. I don't believe there's any conflict of interest, but of abundance of caution, I'm disclosing this as a potential conflict of interest. Are there any other similar disclosures anybody'd like to make prior to the vote?
Thank you, Mayor. Commissioner Hardesty is also a renter and do not anticipate that there's a conflict, but for caution's sake, I will put that on the record.
Very good. Commissioner Fritz?
I am a homeowner, living in the city of Portland. I will neither be benefited nor harmed by this action. Therefore, I have no conflict.
Thank you, Mayor. I am also a renter in the city of Portland, and I have no conflict.
Very good. Colleagues, this is a second reading. So we have already heard extensive presentations, extensive public testimony, lots of deliberations, good conversations. And with that, is there any further business before I call the roll? Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Thank you. This is our final vote on RIP, is my understanding. Is that correct?
Correct.
We took the amendments the last time. Let me just say that for me, I believe that without the residential infill project, the city of Portland would find itself with 75% of its residential properties built out by 2035. This could lead to a scarcity market, making it even more challenging for people to afford to live in the city of Portland. With the residential infill project, the build out percentage is expected to be only at 45%. This will increase the amount of space Portland has to grow for decades to come. I also want to thank all the constituents who showed up in force to make sure their voices were heard on this critical topic. The information provided in testimony throughout this process has helped inform my decision about this, and I believe this proposal is stronger because of the amount of testimony that we've received from all sides during this debate. From the dais and in countless meetings, I am happy with the amount of thoughtful consideration and dialogue that has gone into this process. This is a complicated matter, and I believe the amendment package that we voted on a couple of weeks ago will help ensure RIP's success. I appreciate that many people wanted a different set of amendments, and I want to reiterate that this is not the conclusion of the discussion. I will be keeping a close eye on how RIP impacts the city and am open to having conversations about how we can improve the system moving forward. I want to thank all the hard work that staff have put into this proposal. Specifically, I'd like to thank Jenna Hughes for writing a Racist History of Portland Planning Report, as well as Ryan Karen and Tom Armstrong for their assistance on what I believe was a very, very strong report. Additionally, I want to thank Morgan Tracy, Sandra Wood, Tony Lamb, and Joe Zender for all their great work on this important policy. This policy has been analyzed, discussed, and drafted more times than I can count. And throughout the process, staff have engaged and updated me in my office on a regular basis. This level of thorough work and communication is of critical importance for all matters that come before the City Council, and doubly so for a topic as complicated as the residential infill project. I look forward to casting my final vote today, and I am happy to vote aye.
You daily.
The Residential Infill Project, or RIP, has been in the works for years, long before I took my seat on City Council. In its years of development, RIP has become a zoning lightning rod, and it's pitted Portland's affordable housing advocates against people who are concerned with neighborhood character and preservation. This conversation is complex, and it's been challenging, and because I respect so many people on both sides of this debate, I want to take a couple minutes to delve into some of the finer points that I think it's important that the community understands. I have had four primary concerns during the development of this policy. One is that we encourage the preservation of existing homes. We don't want to see a rash of demolitions. We have thousands of quality old homes, and those homes are the greenest homes that we have, are existing homes, and there are lower impact ways to increase units and density. So that's one. Two is to incentivize the types of housing we need, which are units affordable to households earning under 100% of MFI, and more accessible units. Three, prevent displacement. And four, deliver the benefits of RIP to average homeowners who currently do not have access to capital to develop ADUs or do internal conversions. I'd say that we've made progress on all of these except for delivering the benefits of RIP to average homeowners. And I am committed to continuing this work, even though we're passing the policy today. As Commissioner Hardesty noted, it's not done. So first, I want to talk about encouraging preservation. The project reduces the size of development allowed. Currently, our code allows for homes to be demolished and replaced with a 6,750 square foot single family home on most lots in Portland. And I think we all know what those houses look like, and that they're not remotely affordable, and that they're not the type of housing that we want or need in Portland. So under today's proposal, a standard development would be no bigger than 3,500 square feet, still quite large, but nearly half the size of what's allowed today. My office championed the deeper affordability amendment, which will ensure that when a developer chooses to provide more affordable housing, they will get more space to build with, which will create more affordable family-sized units. We also have a visitability requirement, which is exciting to me as a disability advocate and someone who struggled for years to find affordable, accessible housing for my family. RIP will require visitable, which is a strange and odd word for some people, visitable units in at least one unit on sites that are larger than a duplex. And that means that at a very minimum, a person in a wheelchair can access the first floor of the home. So they can enter the home. I believe there's a bathroom on the first floor. And that's exciting. That also provides potential for converting those visitable units into accessible fully accessible units. RIP will increase accessory dwelling unit options. It provides greater flexibility for basement ADUs, which will incentivize internal conversions. And by allowing 1 to 2 ADUs and limiting the size of new homes, again, we're encouraging homeowners to build on their existing homes and create lower impact density. I want to acknowledge some of the community concerns about RIP and address misinformation I've heard regarding this project and share why RIP is so critical for Portland's future. RIP will provide a variety of housing choices. RIP doesn't ban single family homes and it will not destroy Portland's neighborhoods. What it will do is open the door for the missing middle housing to exist across our city. I think it's important to get some perspective on the potential impacts of this project. Current estimates suggest that over 20 years, we may see an additional 5,000 units built in Portland because of RIP. That's 250 units a year. I don't think that's what people are imagining. I think people are imagining bulldozers coming in and raising entire neighborhoods and replacing them with skinny houses or whatever your worst nightmare is. And that is not likely to happen. Our current default one-size-fits-all policy reinforces neighborhoods of increasingly unaffordable single homes. RIP creates more opportunity for different types of housing that will meet our current and future needs, and it will provide more housing option for Portlanders with modest income. I want to point out that despite our urban growth boundary and despite a significant population increase, we are not even in the top 25 most dense cities in the country. So again, I think some of the fears about density are unfounded. And I'm trying to pare down my remarks. I'm almost done. Bear with me, everyone. We cannot deny the impacts that exclusionary zoning has had and their racist origins. When the Supreme Court ruled about 100 years ago that it was unconstitutional to prevent the sale of property to an individual based on race, we saw zoning codes proliferate across the country. And income became a proxy for race, because by setting the entry price so high, communities were able to exclude certain types of housing and certain people. So I think that is a vitally important part of the conversation that BPS did a great job detailing in their presentation to us about the racist origins of zoning. I'm going to wrap this up with thank yous to all of the staff and community members who have stayed engaged, written, and met with my office over the course of the last 3.5 years. I'll include a full thank you to everyone involved in a post online, but I want to specifically thank Neighbors Welcome for their continued advocacy and RIP. Thank you to BPS's dedicated staff, particularly Morgan Tracy and Sandra Wood, who have led this lengthy project. And finally, I want to thank my senior policy advisor, Andreas Oswell, who first started working on RIP on the Planning Commission and has seen this project through to its completion. Portlanders pride themselves in welcoming all, and this policy demonstrates our inclusive values. I happily vote aye.
Fritz.
The residential infill project was initiated in 2016 as part of the comprehensive plan adoption. The concept plan that the council adopted in December of that year laid out a realistic and attainable approach in fulfillment of key comprehensive plan goals for which anti-displacement and housing affordability activists had worked so hard to advocate. The current plan strays from those original commitments and contradicts comprehensive plan policies around gentrification, equitable development, and climate change. By allowing development far from centers and corridors, we are allowing housing to be developed in areas without safe, immediate access to transit. We are promoting a continued reliance on cars, which is antithetical to our climate goals. Our planet is on fire. In recent weeks, we saw 100 degree temperatures in the Arctic. We saw the last intact ice field of Canada break off. Our planet is on fire. If we don't act with urgency, all human life on Earth is at risk. I understand my colleagues' desire to be seen to be doing something to provide more housing for Portlanders. There is no recognition in this ordinance that in the 8 years previous councils worked on the Portland plan and the comprehensive plan, the council added capacity for 49,000 new homes. We have plenty of zoned capacity for new development, all planned lot by lot to add housing where the new residents will have access to transit, services, jobs, sidewalks, and other amenities that make urban living joyful. The comprehensive plan and map adopted after work by Mayors Adams and Hales, Commissioner Fish and me with others, has capacity for 249,000 new homes. This council is voting for changes that throw out 40 years of land use planning in Portland by adding more density without regard for access to transit and services. Our planet is on fire. There is no more important issue at stake in this vote. Putting new homes where they will never have transit, never have sidewalks, never be close to jobs and services will mean that we won't be able to meet the climate emergency goals we all voted for just a few weeks ago. I live 8 miles from downtown. My neighborhood will have capacity for hundreds of new homes in this plan. Absent adequate sidewalk and transportation infrastructure, new residents will have to drive to groceries, jobs, schools, and services. While I welcome new neighbors, I don't welcome in full on those terms. Even acknowledging the immediate need for affordable housing, this ordinance won't accomplish that goal. All four of the people of color and East Portland representatives on the Planning and Sustainability Commission voted against it because of its known impact on demolitions and displacement in neighborhoods vulnerable to developers buying up affordable rentals and first-time homes that would be available to first-time home buyers. We heard this from the dissenting Planning and Sustainability Commission members who voted against the plan. It narrowly made it through the commission on a 5-4 vote, with the casting votes at the forwarding motion being made by a developer who had to recuse himself from the votes on details due to his financial interest in the outcome. I greatly appreciate the work of those who are committed to addressing the challenge of displacement threats. I thank the community leaders who championed the adoption of anti-displacement policies in the comprehensive plan, as well as the dedicated staff of the Planning and Sustainability Anti-Displacement Team. I honor the work of Tony Lamb, who we lost just 2 weeks ago. Tony brought a commitment to racial justice to his work at the city, and his colleagues will continue to carry the torch on the work that he valued deeply. Thank you, Andrea Pastor, Catherine Hartiger, and Ryan Curran. I honor you. Unfortunately, this vote disrespects the planning policies on anti-displacement we worked so hard to enshrine in the comprehensive plan. Policy 5.15, gentrification displacement risk. Evaluate plans and investments, significant new infrastructure and significant new development for the potential to increase housing costs for or cause displacement of communities of color, low and moderate income households and renters. Identify and implement strategies to mitigate the anticipated impacts. Policy 3.3, equitable development. Guide development, growth, and public facility investment to reduce disparities. Encourage equitable access to opportunities. Mitigate the impacts of development on income disparity, displacement, and housing affordability, and produce positive outcomes for all Portlanders. And policy 7.4, climate change. Update and implement strategies to reduce carbon emissions and impacts and increase resilience through plans and investment and public education. I believe all members of this council share similar values about providing housing and home ownership options that prioritize wealth generation and mitigate displacement risk amongst Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. In the past, people of color were excluded from home ownership. I reject the allegation that people of color are intentionally excluded now. Zoning is not the problem. I've seen it happen in my hometown in Yorkshire, England. Where I grew up, there were no people of color living near me. Now the streets of single family homes where I grew up has my majority minority home ownership. I believe the zone changes proposed in or being adopted in this project do not protect home ownership opportunities and will instead have the adverse impact of concentrating wealth in the hands of a small group of developers and corporate real rental owners. It will promote more rental housing, not wealth creation through home ownership, and not necessarily even more affordable rental housing. Our planet is on fire. In allowing the development of tri and fourplexes on gravel and curbless streets, we have offered a dubious solution in the local transportation improvement charge that will not guarantee that sidewalks will be built wherever new developments occur. In fact, it will ensure that people living in the new homes will never have to paved streets or sidewalks in their lifetimes. By including the previously identified displacement risk areas in the current plan, new infill development may be concentrated in rapidly gentrifying areas like Lentz, Brentwood, Darlington, Powellhurst, Gilwood, and other areas of East Portland. This vote disproportionately affects and displaces people currently able to live in those affordable neighborhoods. The plan will perpetuate further displacements of Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. There are no assurances that the community's intent that this plan is intended to support will be better off as a result of these code changes. As I mentioned last week, I am grateful to the careful work of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff to include my team, the community, and me in this process as it unfolded. Thank you, Joe Zender, Sandra Wood, Morgan Tracy, and Julia Giesler for your work over many years. I'm very sad that this project represents a significant step back in good land use planning and climate action planning for Portland. Our planet is on fire. This action will make it burn faster. I am grateful to Claire Adamsick, Tim Crail, and Tom Bizot for all of their good work to support good land use planning in Portland, and everyone who participated in the Portland Plan, the 2016 Comprehensive Plan, and this process. This may be the saddest vote I have cast in 12 years on the council. No.
Wheeler.
There are many thank yous I'd like to give in shaping this five-year project. But before I do that, I want to reflect on the conversations that the residential infill project has sparked throughout our city. For decades, as people are aware, Portland and the state of Oregon have long been admired and studied by land use planners as a smart growth experiment that's gone largely right. People who study Oregon's land use planning decisions learn about Governor Tom McCall and the broad and diverse range of supporters behind Senate Bill 100, the original legislation that created a statewide land use planning system here in Oregon. This system protects Oregon's natural and working lands. It encourages vibrant, walkable, rollable, and bikeable neighborhoods, and gave Oregonians a seat at the table throughout land use decisions. At the same time, our community members, nonprofit organizations, and our city staff have brought to renewed life the unfortunate outcomes of market-driven housing, a system that doesn't meet our goals of creating housing for all in every neighborhood of Portland. This destructive side of Oregon's land use planning program includes the web of laws and investments that exclude Black, Indigenous, and people of color from our neighborhoods, our schools, our places of worship, recreation, and work. It's clear to see the consequences of these laws when we look to the data, our Goal 10 housing reports, our U.S. Census Bureau data, the growing list of those applying for permanent affordable housing, the ever-expanding camps of those experiencing houselessness. The COVID-19 pandemic has only exacerbated these realities. Why is this still happening? Why, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Fair Housing Act of 1968, and so many landmark Supreme Court decisions, are we still plagued with the symptoms of a broken system? I encourage those watching or listening to this to read, to watch, and to listen to those who documented key milestones and decisions to help answer this question. The Color of Law, written by Richard Rothstein. Any YouTube video and research publication by Tricia Rose at the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. Evicted by Matthew Desmond. The works of Dr. Robert Bullard, often named the father of environmental justice. The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Freedom is a Constant Struggle by Angela Davis. The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. Research about housing policy and displacement from Portland's own Dr. Lisa Bates and Marisa Zapata at the Toulon School of Urban Studies and Planning here at Portland State University. These thought leaders help us learn about the bigger picture, the why, the levers of power, and the decisions that have been made that have harmed millions and benefited a select few. Despite the great accomplishments of our original land use planning and zoning laws, these new thought leaders are showing us that what we have in place, though good, is not great. And though it serves many, it does not serve all. We must continue to come together to listen, to read, to discuss, to center and support those who are experiencing housing instability, and to take action in our land use and development decisions that make Portland a home for everyone. I'm not going to pretend that the changes to the zoning code that we're about to adopt rectify all of the past harms. They don't. But I fully believe that allowing for more housing types and a greater mix of incomes in a single dwelling neighborhood that covers, by the way, almost half of our city's geography is a crucial step in the right direction. This brings me to my thank yous to the many people who shaped the residential infill project and have made this change possible. As I said, over the entirety of my administration and my leadership of a number of the bureaus involved in this process, but also to prior city councils and prior mayoral administrations. First, I want to thank my colleagues. We've had some very spirited conversations, and they've included everything about the role of government relating to the built environment, encouraging housing affordability and availability, and what each of us think neighborhood character means, because not everybody has the same definition of what constitutes neighborhood character. Commissioner Udaly, I want to thank you for your steadfast focus on ensuring tenant protections in every legislative land use policy that's come to council. This project is no exception to that. I appreciate the solutions-oriented approach that you brought, adding a significant bonus for permanent affordable housing after working with several community partner organizations. I also appreciate your laser focus on policy language to ensure that the proposals require some of the units to be accessible for people of all ages and all abilities. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you to Andres Oswald and Jamie Dumahel from your office for their leadership as well. Commissioner Hardesty, I want to thank you for your vision and your insights on how we can make Portland more inclusive, more livable, and more affordable. I won't forget an insightful question that you frequently raise, particularly as I think about the signals we tend to send to the housing market, which is, how do we legislate greed? I appreciate you keeping us honest and clear about the outcomes of this missing middle housing proposal. Thank you, Commissioner, and thanks to your staff, in particular, Derek Bradley. Commissioner Fritz, I want to thank you for your clear position on this policy and on Senate Bill 534, state legislation that allowed houses on certain narrow lots. It's because of your experience, your wisdom, and your professionalism that my staff and I can engage in substantive public policy debate. Your comments last week embodied how you approached this work. You argue the policy and not the person. And I want to thank you for setting an extremely high bar in these public policy debates. I believe we're all better for it. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you to Claire Adamczyk. Next, thank you to our community partners, to the diverse and broad range of coalitions who weighed in to strengthen this policy, the Portland for Everyone Coalition, Portland Neighbors Welcome, members of Housing Oregon, Business for a Better Portland, Small Business Developers Alliance, Home Builders Association, and our neighborhood networks like the Mount Scott, Arleta Neighborhood Association, and the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods. Thank you to the many community organizers and advocates who voiced constant support and needed amendments for housing affordability and availability, and connected Portlanders to conversations about what equitable smart growth policies can and should look like. We wouldn't be here without all of you. Madeline Kovacs, Tony Jordan, Mary Kyle McCurdy, Nolan Leinhardt, Sean Carpenter, Michael Anderson, Henry Kramer, Holly Balcom, Aaron Brown, Doug Klotz, Sarah Wright, the AARP Dream Team, Bandana Shrefa, Joyce Damonen, Ruby Houghton-Pitts, and Elaine Friesen-Strom. Safe Routes to Schools, Carl Schlauschauer, and Oregon Walks, Jess Thompson, Izzy Armenta, Ina Levin, and Steph Ralph. The Streets Trusts, Richa Pudiel, Cully Association of Neighborhoods, particularly David Sweet and Oriana Magnera, Proud Grounds, Diane Lynn, and Habitat for Humanity's Steve Messinetti, Green Hammers, Mike Beamer, and Eli Spivak, Ashley Henry and Addie Leverett, Mike Wessling and Brink Communications Team, who helped to simplify this complex code change, Pam Fan, Nicole Johnson, Cameron Harrington, Alan Lazo, and the Anti-Displacement Coalition organized, who held and I hope will continue to hold the city accountable to its displacement policies in the comprehensive plan. The Sunrise Movement Portland chapter for linking our land use changes to our climate actions in a meaningful way. And finally, thank you to our incredible city staff, Sandra Wood, Morgan Tracy, Joe Zender, Andrea Durbin, Donnie Oliveira, and Eden Dabbs. Our Planning and Sustainability Commission, especially Kat Schultz, Eli Spivak, and Chris Smith, who served as chair and vice chairs during RIP's passage. The Portland Housing Bureaus, Shannon Callahan, Molly Rogers, and Matt Schabold. Our Public Safety Service Bureaus, who analyzed the potential impacts from this new potential for development, particularly Nate Dakari. Our Infrastructure Bureaus, particularly PBOT Director Chris Warner and LTIC Program Manager Teresa Boyle, who provided their own analyses and also helped with the LTIC expansion ordinance we passed just last month. Lynn Lee Reese and Lauren King, who keep all of us focused on building a strong, defensible, and legal record. And our former mayor, Charlie Hales, and his staff, who formed the Residential Infill Project Stakeholder Advisory Committee. And last but not least, my staff, particularly Sam Diaz, who've managed this project for nearly 4 years. It's been a team effort across many boroughs with many community members, neighborhood associations, developers, and nonprofit organizations. I thank you all. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next, Carla, we'll go to the regular agenda. 660, please.
Update resolution requiring Portland Bureau to immediately cease cooperation with militarized federal forces.
Colleagues, this item updates the resolution we took up on a 4/5 basis and adapted on July 22nd, prohibiting communication between the Portland Police Bureau and federal forces who at that time were occupying the downtown area of our community. That item came together very quickly and it was unclear on certain key points. While we were able to clarify our intent on an interim basis, City Attorney Tracy Reeve advised that we take this item back up to formally update the guidance based on information that we have. Additionally, through conversations with the governor about the Oregon State Police deployment in Portland, we identified another piece requiring clarification, which has supported both myself as well as Governor Brown. The first version of this item had the effect of prohibiting communication between the police bureau and the Oregon State Police securing the federal courthouse next door to the Justice Center. It also had the effect of prohibiting any communication between Portland police and local year-round federal staff who are security for Portland's federal buildings. When we figured that out, we clarified, again on a temporary basis, that our employees would still be able to communicate with the OSP officers guarding the courthouse. And we came up with a workaround so that OSP could act as the communications liaison between our staff and local federal agents. But the OSP deployment, as you know, is temporary. And when they leave, we will need to be able to communicate with local agents in that building. Federal forces are gone, and if we want them to stay gone, we must be able to appropriately coordinate with the year-round officials working in that building. Council intent in the first instance was clear. We did not want our people working with federal forces sent by the president to occupy our streets and bring increased escalation and increased violence to our community. Today, we're again being clear. We are comfortable with our staff being in communication with Oregon State Police and other officers who are on the ground in our community year-round and are assigned to secure the federal courthouse. And finally, I believe we are in agreement about our top priority, keeping the president and his tactics out of our community. Tracy Reeve, our legal expert, is here to answer any questions anybody may have on this item. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Tracy. I want to be really clear that this resolution did remove the last paragraph that directed Portland Police to, once OSP was gone, that they could continue their interactions with the federal government. In our conversation yesterday, I was really clear that I would not support a resolution that gave Portland Police the authority to once again start interacting with federal agents based on their behavior when the federal occupiers showed up in Portland. So I just wanna be clear that what we talked about yesterday is in fact what we're voting on today, and those changes in fact were made. We're not hearing you, Tracy. You're talking, you're not on mute, but
there you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. That change was not made because I did discuss that, but because of the current draft still has that provision in it based on discussions and the need to consider the version that would continue to, that would enable Oregon State Police to withdraw and our police force to communicate with the federal agents. So that still needs to be sorted out.
So Mayor, I did talk to the governor yesterday, and there is an alternative approach between allowing Portland Police to once again engage with federal agents in Portland, and that in between would be for us, for the governor to leave two Oregon State Troopers here. That would be paid for out of the current budget allotment of Portland Police Bureau. I could not support that. Just gives Portland Police the authority to misuse their relationship with federal law enforcement officers here. So I cannot vote for this resolution if that language still exists in it.
Oops, Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Hello, Tracy. I just want to clarify a couple things and then ask you a couple questions. My intent with this resolution was to have a very narrow focus on communications with federal forces that were here through the president's executive order. And there were some kind of wild speculations about the unintended consequences of the resolution. So first, I want to be clear that we're making this adjustment today to the resolution because it was created before the arrival of Oregon State Police. So Tracy, in just very plain language for our benefit and the viewing public, can you describe the changes in the resolution? Oh, we can't hear you. You're muted.
Essentially, the resolution, thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Essentially, the resolution clarifies that council's intent was to preclude the Portland Police Bureau from cooperating with federal officers sent pursuant to an executive order to engage in crowd control and protest activities. Council's intent was not, for example, to prevent the Portland Police Bureau from calling the Coast Guard if someone was drowning in the Willamette River. And because obviously the resolution was prepared quickly given the exigent circumstances that we were facing. And so some of those demarcations were not clear. In addition, council's intent was very clearly that if Portland Police Bureau members disobeyed the council directive, they would be subject to the disciplinary process. But it stated that they would be subject to discipline rather than subject to the disciplinary process. And all of our city disciplinary process requires due process, which means we're not supposed to assume that somebody's going to be disciplined before we start the process. So we made a technical adjustment there just to make clear that council's intent was that anybody violating this would be subject to the disciplinary process. And then finally, two things. Oregon State Police are technically currently deputized as federal officers for purposes of guarding the courthouse. Because of that, we were very concerned that since they were deputized federal officers, the original resolution could be read to preclude PPB from communicating with them, which was not council's intent. So this clears that up. And then finally, as the mayor explained, an issue arose after the Oregon State Police began assuming those responsibilities, which is that they're here temporarily, and it is there needs to be a mechanism for the Portland Police Bureau to communicate with the local federal marshals who are responsible for guarding the actual courtroom facilities and courtroom personnel, and Federal Protective Services, which is responsible for guarding the physical facilities. There are local folks in Portland that are assigned always here that were here before the additional agents were sent. And so as currently drafted, the last paragraph of the resolution provides that once the Oregon State Police members are withdrawn, the Portland Police Bureau could resume communications with the locally assigned marshals and Federal Protective Service officers. And that's the provision that Commissioner Hardesty and I were speaking of.
Okay. And to be clear, these individuals would be here regardless of the executive order.
Correct. They're always here.
And this will not fundamentally change any of the restrictions put in place by the original resolution.
Correct. It would still maintain that the Portland Police Bureau is prohibited from cooperating or communicating with any federal forces deployed by the president under an executive order to Portland to engage in protest-related, crowd control-related activities, broadly speaking.
Great. Thank you.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Tracy, we found out later that there was a Homeland Security officer embedded in Portland Police Command Center from the very beginning of the protest. That was not someone sent by the president. That was who knows who sent them, but we know they were embedded. That is not something that I would want to give permission for Portland Police Bureau to do again, because we've seen how they responded when the federal troops were here on the ground. And so again, if we are giving them the authority to once again be in communication with the feds, I don't have confidence that they will restrict their communications to merely the Coast Guard or other folks that they would normally work with. And so again, with that additional sentence added into those additional two sentences added into this resolution, it is not the resolution I thought I was gonna be supporting, and I cannot support it with that very open invitation for Portland Police to engage with feds. I can't do that. Thank you.
Any further questions? I still have two hands raised, but I think those are residual. Carl, is there any public testimony on this item?
Yes, Mayor, we had six people register, but I see about four are on the line.
Very good.
We'll go with Hung Nam.
Carl, I'm not hearing anybody.
Yeah, I'm checking. Looks like we may have lost him on that line.
Okay.
Is Jocelyn, let's go with Kevin Cherry.
Very good. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The resolution being considered today identifies a goal of, quote, de-escalating tensions during demonstrations. What I want to emphasize is that Trump and his federal invasion of our city are but a very small piece of the problem, and we should be wary of attempts to distract us from the larger picture of racism and state violence, including racism and state violence perpetrated in our own city by our own taxpayer-funded local law enforcement. Let's be clear. The tenure of federal forces in Portland was marked by the exact same strategies and brutality as Mayor Wheeler's police force has enacted, past and present, to this very day. Banning collaboration between PPB and federal forces does nothing to address the rotten gang that is our own local police force. It's ironic that Mayor Wheeler takes a public stance on the side of protesters and against police violence, but only when it applies to federal forces. All other times, he swallows and regurgitates police propaganda and demonizes those mobilizing nightly against police violence. For example, during an August 7th news conference, Mayor Wheeler publicly accused protesters of attempted murder and went so far as to accuse them of giving re-election material to Donald Trump. Literally, the next day, Trump repeated the same narrative on national TV, directly quoting Mayor Wheeler's accusation and using it to decry, quote, left-wing violence extremism. As others have noted, the event in question involved a small fire contained in one garbage can outside the building, which had multiple unblocked exits if someone needed to get out. To Mayor Wheeler, our police commissioner, I suggest you look in the mirror to see whose words and actions are being used as B-roll material for Donald Trump and right-wing extremism. I also ask you to evaluate why you're so quick to repeat PPB's characterizations and demonize protesters, but yet you have not said one word about the multiple pipe bombs thrown at protesters in Laurelhurst, a literal attempted murder. Protesters are not the enemy. It's worth noting, City Council would not have defunded the GVRT or school resource officers if it weren't for these same protesters. An independent police oversight board would not be on the November ballot if it weren't for these same protesters. Shame on you, Mayor Wheeler, for claiming the protests have no longer been about racial justice and police accountability. Yes, this is all very complicated. Yes, there are many different actors and stakeholders with competing narratives and competing motivations. But one message I've heard over and over again that I would like to reiterate is this. Council should find a creative, bold way to immediately defund PPB, and Mayor Wheeler should resign. Thank you.
Kevin, thank you for your testimony. I fundamentally disagree with your characterization. I just want to say that clearly on the record. I'm not sure you got correct what my admonition was or who my statement was addressed towards. I stand by my statement 100%, but I appreciate your perspective. Next individual, please, Carla.
Is Jocelyn McCauley.
Joseph, are you on board?
Jocelyn.
Jocelyn, are you on board?
Looks like
yes.
Hello. Right here. There you go. You're good to go.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Jocelyn McCauley. I live in Rose City Park neighborhood. Thank you for this opportunity to participate. I am also speaking out in concern over this document. The first line begins my concerns, quote, requiring PPB to cease cooperating with militarized federal forces fails to recognize that our PPB is militarized against Portlanders. This is not a new problem, and this has been highlighted for years by protesters and data scientists that the militarization of our own police via their costume and lethal protest weaponry is directly responsible for the escalation of violence at our peaceful protests. I am speaking from being informed on what is happening nightly, thanks to the persistence of our local press. They continue to report in the face of excessive force and false declarations of unlawful assembly and physical assault by this militarized PPB presence. For our community to trust attempts at de-escalation, you must first stop PPB from gearing up in militarized riot costumes and from using chemical weaponry against protesters. My continued look at this document also was conflicted with the disclaimers that were inserted in sections A and F. A is the one that ends with, quote, this prohibition shall not apply to the operational support to or from federally deputized OSP members. And section F, which Commissioner Hardesty has brought up, adds the disclaimer, quote, does not restrict communications or cooperation between PPB members and employees of the U.S. Marshals Service. I also urge you to recognize that any cooperation with these disclaimers in place still supports the militarized federal forces you are claiming to oppose. As a function of being deputized, Oregon State Patrol joins the U.S. Marshals in not being accountable to any local oversight, and they will be shielded from litigation. As these exceptions currently allow, PPB will be collaborating with federal task forces and continuing to put Portlanders at even more risk. With PPB currently targeting Black leaders at protest, as shown with the recent false arrest of Demetria Hester, and with PPB circling peaceful protests with data surveillance planes, and with PPB currently injuring medics and pepper spraying media, how are we to actually hold these attempts at de-escalation as being forthright and honorable and trustworthy? I urge you to stop declaring protests as unlawful assemblies, to stop outfitting our police in militarized riot gear, to stop all support of this racist federal government and their task forces that are inserted into our Portland. This concludes my statement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your perspective, Jocelyn.
Next is Gia Naranjo Rivera.
Welcome.
All right, Dr. Naranjo Rivera here once again. I'm glad to be with you all today. I really appreciate the perspectives that Kevin and Jocelyn shared. And I'm here speaking on behalf of a group of concerned citizens. We're called PDX Rising, a consortium of folks who have been providing food, clothing, medical care, etc. to both Portland peaceful and nonviolent Portland protesters, as well as the houseless outside what we affectionately refer to as the injustices, or the federal courthouse, the Multnomah County Justice Center, and the Edith Wyatt federal building. I'm also very concerned from my professional perspective as a human and civil rights scholar, as well as a doctor in public health, about the impacts of the ongoing violence. As some of my colleagues have mentioned, the use of excessive force, the false pretense of unlawful assembly, which is used to enact widespread and extreme violence against largely nonviolent, and we're talking about, you know, once in a while someone might throw a water bottle. And at this point, there are times when there have been 100% peaceful protests and have been vicious attacks by police against innocent and unarmed people. It needs to stop. And the collusion with state and national agents is a major part of the problem. The behavior is racist. It is targeting medics and media. The surveillance persists, as well as use of chemical weaponry, which was occurring by PPB toward these protesters before and continues after the rise and fall of the larger numbers of federal agents in our area. I reported last week and there were no responses, so I will pause and ask for response from our city council members around First Amendment violations, illegal searches, illegal arrests, abuses in PPB detention, including violence, denying access to counsel and medical care, theft of property, unwarranted solitary confinement, and also excessive use of force, including lethal arms, the chemical weapons, aiming at heads, hearts, and genitals, and the PPB tackling people with large numbers of officers. And this is exacerbated when they collude with other armed forces. So I will pause here and ask for comment, please, from the council. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for your perspective.
Next is Edith Gillis.
Good morning.
Good morning. It states, whereas the council finds it imperative that PPB and OSP work in a unified and coordinated command structure to de-escalate tensions during demonstrations in the city, this amendment does not address the good reasons for the original ordinance, nor the tensions during demonstrations in the city, nor the violence by the feds that the PPB also did before and since with and without OSB, at and far away from federal property, nor from the Seattle Coast Guard and PPB brutalizing and ramming their boats over kayaktivists and denying them first aid, nor PPB and DHS harming people at ICE. I agree with Gia, with Jocelyn, with former Portland Police Chief and Mayor Tom Potter, and Commissioner Hardesty and others who's now, because of my brain injury, I cannot remember. In violation of various laws over the last 2 weeks, PPB and OSP have worked together in unified and coordinated manner against the people and public health and safety of Portlanders, ever more escalating tensions. Themselves, police or so-called law enforcement from any agency or jurisdiction or mercenary corporation in riot gear and or using militarized equipment, practices, attitude when they assault and batter nonviolent protesters do not de-escalate tensions during demonstrations against police brutality, corruption, criminality, fraud, and illegitimacy. Nor do they de-escalate tensions when they bull rush attacking people the police physically blind, confuse, hurt, and scare, or incapacitate with blinding chemical weapons and pain. Or when the police use strobe lights and physical violence against press they are told have epilepsy with seizures triggered by strobes or brain damage. Nor when they use LRAD threateningly and make false allegations and with conflicting impossible to obey commands, they then brutalize and arrest people for obeying. Nor when they brutalize people with disabilities and mobility challenges the police worsened or caused, nor when they use hate speech, nor when they prevent medical care for people they have wounded or might be dying in front of them, when they attack medics and then mace them point blank in the face while cops are on the medic's back. A lot of these protests began because of police coolly beating someone up, holding them down, kneeling on the neck. Exactly what we've seen last night and the night before that, and the night before that, by Portland police with the so-called federally deputized OSP. Nor when they attacked the clearly identified press during their job defending democracy and public health and safety with documentation of police committing crimes. Nor when they refused to help survivors of domestic or sexual violence or hate crimes. Nor when they sexually assault captive and incapacitated Portlanders. Nor when they plant or destroy or tamper with evidence, nor when they lie to the mayor or press and libel their victims or wrongly arrest and perjure. The Portland Police Bureau and Oregon State Police have each collectively and individually committed violent crimes and property damage and hate crimes and violated the civil rights and human rights of Portlanders over the last decades and throughout the last 2 weeks during protests and have neglected their duties, have refused to prevent or stop crimes in process, and refused to apprehend, documented, and witnessed violent criminals attacking protesters and civilians in the facility of protests. And they have refused to appropriately render aid
to 3 minutes. Violent crimes
or people with injuries. The way that you de-escalate this, the way that you accomplish what you say you're going to do, is to stop the police from harming the public and to hold the police individually for their wrongs. Do not allow the police to determine or label gatherings as unlawful assemblies or riots or other excuses to give the police themselves more money and power immunity. Have someone who is not police, who is publicly accountable civilian public employee at the scene under oath, identify and announce lawfully or unlawfully assembly or riot, and have that person trained, experienced, and skilled in crowd psychology, trauma and care, needs of diverse communities, often most policed and harmed by the PPIC, the law, emotional self-regulation.
All of these are important points, somewhat unrelated to what we're discussing.
No.
Commissioner Daly?
The way we address this.
Thank you. Commissioner Daly?
Mayor, I'm sorry. I'll hold my comments till we're done with public testimony.
Thank you.
Were there more?
Carla, do we have others?
We have one more who registered.
Thank you.
Christina Malamon.
Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, loud and clear.
Hello, thank you. I'm with the Slavic community, and when feds were here, the agreement that you've made with the feds is if they leave, the Portland police will be able to take care of the rioting and keep Portlanders safe. But what has happened instead is it has only become worse. The feds are gone, but the riots have not stopped. Antifa is now in Portland neighborhoods, and Portlanders and each citizen deserve to live in a safe place. They're now in neighborhoods and apartments, and people are in fear. And so I spoke to a few police officers recently, and I asked, you know, how they are doing. And so it was a very it touched me down to my heart when I heard the story from the police officer. So he's a young individual, and his wife is soon to give birth to a little girl. And he said that I really hope that I still have my vision to see my little girl when she's born. And so now that we have the feds out of Portland, I want to make sure that the police officers have the resources and that they have the equipment and the things that they need in order to stay healthy and to stay alive, because every person's lives matter. So what Antifa does is they have lasers and they point into eyes of the officers. And a lot of these officers have lost their vision and might never see again. And they also need better protection in their vests in order to make sure that they're protected against rifles, because they've seen some people with rifles at these riots. And you as leaders are responsible for all of the Oregonians. We've voted for you, and we trusted that you will take care of all of us. And so I really ask that you get peace into Oregon. We really are tired of seeing the destruction all over Portland, and that you also provide police officers with everything they need in order to stay healthy and alive. And I really thank you for everything that you guys do. God bless.
Thank you, Christina. Thank you for being here today and sharing your perspective. Carla, does that complete our public testimony?
I believe that does, Mayor. Looks like that's all.
Very good. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. I am just trying to figure out the exchange between Commissioner Hardesty and Tracy Reeves. I'm curious if Commissioner Hardesty is going to be introducing an amendment or if we're just going to move ahead as is. Oh, you're muted.
It would have to happen at least once, right? Let me just say that no, because I anticipated that language had been removed, so I did not come prepared with an amendment. If that language is still in it and we are calling for a vote, my vote is no. So it's just that simple. I thought that we had a plan moving forward. The governor agreed with that plan, and so I have no interest in allowing Portland Police Bureau to once again be in direct communications with the feds based on what we learned long after the protest started about that relationship. So it's unfortunate that that change was not made before it was presented to us today.
And just so I understand, because the focus of this resolution was specifically on federal forces here under the executive order, are you wanting expanded language that would continue to prohibit communication regardless of whether federal forces were here under executive order or not?
So I still have my same concern that Portland police officers had federal agents embedded long before 45 sent his goon squad in. And so I have no confidence that giving Portland Police Bureau the authority to communicate with the federal agents won't exacerbate the tensions that already exist in our community. And so the alternative plan is to have two OSP officers be assigned here, and they will continue to be the liaison, and that is a position I can support. I do not support Portland Police as it currently exists being engaged in any relationship with our federal government at all.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. I just wanted to make sure I understood. Can we hear from Tracy Reeve?
Yes, and I think this is a choice for the council. My understanding is that I have had communications with attorneys for local in the U.S. Attorney's Office here who feel strongly that it's imperative for our local officers to be able to communicate with PPB. And I've also had, and Commissioner Hardesty and I did discuss this issue yesterday. I think the concern is the very last sentence of Section F. And I subsequently had discussions with the mayor's office, with whom I've obviously been working on this resolution. And based on their conversations with the mayor's office and the Oregon State Police, they felt it was important that we continue to be able to have our local federal officers speak with our local Portland Police Bureau. And based on my conversations with the police bureau, I do understand that, as Commissioner Hardesty said, I don't know, but you know, if the term embedded is the one I would use, but there was prior to, you know, when the initial demonstrations were occurring and prior to the time that the federal, outside federal officers from different agencies were sent in, there was a federal officer that was present in the Portland Command Center to observe and coordinate, was not, as I understand it, calling the shots or anything, but was present with the local, this was before the folks that the president sent in had been present in the command center. So I believe that's the concern that's being articulated. And so my understanding is that Oregon State Police cannot leave until this communication issue is sorted out. And so that's, you know, now council needs to decide how that best can happen.
And I'll just add that the governor is going to be speaking to the undersecretary today. And in our conversation yesterday, the alternative proposal was one that she was going to present because, you know, I told her, just like I've been very straightforward with Tracy and you guys this morning, that the alternative is just not something I would consider.
Could I ask a follow-up question, Commissioner Hardesty? Because I'm trying to understand what your objection is. So if we have two state police officers, and it's my understanding you are proposing that the city pay for the two state police officers who would then communicate directly with the feds and effectively be the communication bridge between PPB and the feds. Why couldn't PPB play that role with a clear understanding of what those communications can and cannot be? I don't understand what the point of paying extra for two officers who are simply playing telephone bridge.
The point is that Portland Police Bureau has lost my trust in believing that they can separate what their responsibility is through the various federal agencies, because they had federal agents embedded and they continue to tell the public that they did not. And when in fact we found out they did, I've lost all confidence that they will keep a strong line between what's acceptable and what isn't. I have more confidence in OSP, which is why.
Here's a question I have. So you are saying that this is the governor's proposal. Is this in fact a proposal that was made by the governor? Because she has not shared this proposal with me.
Well, her and I met yesterday morning at 8:45. Apparently you had talked to her prior to her and I talking, and she called me to get me to support this resolution. I did not know that you were making this change in this resolution.
I have not proposed a change in the resolution.
Well, actually, there is a change, and I don't know who proposed it, whether it was you, OSP, the governor, but all I know is what I thought Tracy was doing, which was cleaning up the language from our last vote, in fact, was what she was doing, in addition to reauthorizing Portland Police to communicate directly with
them. Well, the reason we're bringing this is state police are going to leave, and we either are going to have communication with the locally assigned people who live here in that facility, or we are not. And from a public safety perspective, the situational awareness at a minimum is a requirement for us to be able to effectively operate together. That is the same relationship that the state police have had with the federal officers for the last 2 weeks.
Yes.
And I believe it's imperative that we have that relationship. That's the purpose of this updated resolution.
You and I will fundamentally disagree whether that's imperative.
Well, the governor and I are in agreement that this is imperative.
The governor and I are in agreement that there's an alternative plan.
Well, she has not shared that alternative plan with me. And until she shares it with me, this is the plan that I'm going to vote for.
So when you vote for it, I'm going to not vote for it.
And that's fair.
It will just be that way.
That's democracy.
That's democracy in action, yes. But I want to be really clear. My concern is because we are still investigating incidents of police misconduct. We don't know yet what we don't know about Portland Police Bureau's actions as it related to...
Right. Fine. And all of that is stipulated, but at some point we have to trust the command staff on this bureau. And they're saying, and the governor is saying, and the state police are saying, and I'm saying as the police commissioner, that we need this basic level of communication. As far as people being embedded previously, the police bureau has responded very clearly that the purpose of that embedded individual was situational awareness. We were operating with the county in the Justice Center. The feds were operating literally across the street in the federal courthouse, and we needed that situational awareness. But because there was this perception that there was coordination as the president was bringing additional people into the city, we felt we needed to make that separation. And everybody agreed that as that increased federal presence came to Portland, we needed that additional separation. But the feds are gone now. And it's up to us to be coordinated with those individuals who are locally assigned to the facility across the street from the one that the county and the city are currently engaged in order to make sure that everybody is as safe as possible. So that is the spirit in which this was brought. And this was the conversation that I had with the governor.
Well, you and I had different conversations. That was her first proposal, but that was not where we ended the conversation. And Mayor, you and I can disagree about whether or not Portland Police are the appropriate liaison with the feds in Portland. But I will say that this resolution changed in a way that I cannot support. And for the reasons I've stated. Now, you're saying that this is what has to happen. I'm telling you, it is not what has to happen.
Well, I just don't see the need to pay somebody else to do, you know, basically be telephone operators. I think we can trust our folks to be able to do that.
I don't agree with that, Mayor. And let me just say that if we could, we would not still have people in the street every single night. You would not have your police officers declaring a riot every single night. So I fundamentally disagree that the trust is there between the community and Portland police and the feds. And I'm not sure that all the feds are gone, right? We don't know whether they're gone or not. And I don't want to take that chance by allowing Portland police to continue to engage with the federal government, because we've seen what happens on the ground when that happens. So we can fundamentally disagree, and I'm okay with that. Won't be the first time or the last time you and I disagree.
I suspect you're absolutely right. Commissioner Udaly, you've been waiting patiently.
I don't know if I'd call it patiently, but I didn't really have a choice, did I? Thank you for the conversation, colleagues. Commissioner Hardesty, I think I better understand your position now. And while I am not disinterested in the conversation, my intent in bringing this resolution was an act of resistance against the president and his executive order, which brought unwelcome, uninvited federal forces to occupy our city. So I'm comfortable with supporting this resolution as is, but it sounds like there's another conversation to have, and I would love to have that with you.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Commissioner. I'll wait for you then.
My office was in touch with the governor's public safety advisor yesterday, and there was no mention of an alternative plan. I don't feel comfortable trying to devise an amendment on the fly because of the kind of complexity and sensitivity of this issue, but I'm certainly open to conversation forward.
Let me just say, in my mind, this is a radical change to what we voted on a couple of weeks ago. And it is not something, again, I don't do amendments on the fly either. I talked to Tracy, shared my position and my conversation with the governor. She went and talked to the mayor. Clearly, the mayor disagrees with the alternative plan that the governor and I developed. And that's fine. That's how democracy works. So
I really need to be clear on this. This amendment is allowing deputized OSP officers to communicate between OSP and PPB.
It was the agreement that the mayor and I made when the governor allowed us to have OSP officers here for 2 weeks. The agreement was that OSP would be the only officers communicating with the feds because of the issues I raised earlier. That was the agreement that the mayor and I agreed with when
we allowed. You're talking beyond the executive order. I was talking about
the governor's plan to allow OSP to come so that the feds could save face and leave, right?
Right. But what I'm trying to determine, because this resolution is narrowly focused on the executive order, you're actually wanting to expand the prohibition beyond the executive order on an ongoing basis and prevent PPB from communicating with federal forces.
That is correct. And actually, I wouldn't say ongoing, but it would be that's what I'd like to do. Yes.
Sure. Again, I'm open to that conversation, but that was never the intent of the resolution. So it isn't a fundamental change of the existing resolution. I don't know if there was something taken out or added to the resolution we're voting on today that you're taking issue with. I've been a little bit confused about this debate. And now I think I understand. Yeah.
The last two sentences that were added, it was not
added.
Just
okay.
The administrative changes. Actually reaffirmed Portland Police Bureau's ability to communicate directly with the feds. I do not believe at this time, it is to the city's benefit to have Portland police officers engaged in communication with the feds. Difference.
Without agreeing or disagreeing with you, that is beyond the scope of the original resolution, and I believe that would require another resolution or some further conversation by by council, so.
Well, I suspect the mayor and I will be talking about this quite a bit as we move forward. And again, I don't want to waste your time or the public's time, but this was something that was not what I expected in this resolution, and the fact that it was added. If it was just cleaning up the language, it would have been fine. But the fact that this was, intentionally added because of Portland Police sending us reports every day about how they can't talk to the feds about XYZ, right? I don't think that's necessary. And I'm really want to make sure that the communication is only communication as it pertains to other issues that impact the city of Portland. I'm not confident in the people that will have access to the feds that is so. We've certainly seen a PPA president in communication with feds much more than any of us have been. And that's not acceptable. And so if that's the person that's representing the rank and file, I have real concerns about expanding that authority.
I hear you. I don't necessarily disagree, but this resolution really just serves to clarify the original intent of the resolution that I brought forward and allow the deputized OSP officers to communicate with PPB. So I am comfortable with this as is, but look forward to further conversations.
All right, good discussion. Any further discussion? Carla, please call the roll. Carla, are you still there?
Are you on mute?
Sorry about that, lost myself. Hard to see.
Did you find yourself, Carla?
Yeah.
I greatly appreciate the governor being able to negotiate a withdrawal of the federal occupiers in our community. I also greatly appreciate Commissioner Yu Daly rushing this resolution to ensure that there was clear lines of communication as far as who would be communicating directly with the feds. Today, I am voting no, because again, what I have seen over the last 70 plus days does not give me confidence that Portland Police Bureau will conduct themselves in a manner with our federal government that brings peace and de-escalation into our community. I think the governor and I worked out a better plan because until Portland Police Bureau actually corrects itself, they should have no additional power. Therefore, I am very happy to vote no.
Curtis, you did.
Well, I want to thank the community members who came here today to share their experiences and concerns over our local police bureau's actions against protesters. I want you to know that I hear you and that I believe you, and I in fact have experienced the same things throughout my 30 years of engagement with protests while exercising my constitutional rights. The conversation about transforming policing and public safety has only just begun. This resolution, as I said before, is very narrowly focused on the executive order that brought unwelcome, unwanted, uninvited federal forces into our city to do violence against our community members and to actually escalate tensions on the ground. We struck a deal with the governor that has resulted in a standing down of the federal forces. And this resolution only really serves to, number one, clarify a couple things that were not crystal clear in the original resolution, and then allow Oregon State Police, who have been deputized, to communicate directly with PPB. So I support this resolution, but like I said, I'm very open and interested in
further discussion and steps that we can take to guarantee that the Bureau is acting in accord with our policies and priorities. And I'm especially excited about the continuing conversation about transforming policing and public safety and investing in community. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly, for your clarity and your leadership on this and for what you just said. And I think the key point for me is we need to be getting those conversations about transforming community safety. And you can't have a conversation if some people are not allowed to talk to other people. And so I appreciate the governor negotiating the solution that allowed the invading officers to stop doing what they've been doing. And now, you know, we are going to have a federal presence in Portland, and we need to figure out how to engage them in transforming community safety as well here. This resolution is recommended by the city attorney, and I greatly appreciate Tracy Reeve and all the work that you've been doing. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, for being willing to have the conversations. And we need to be able to get to a point where we can sit down and have conversations. The point has been made that we need changes, and now we need to engage the community to discuss what those changes should be. And so I appreciate the clarity in this resolution. Aye.
Wheeler.
Commissioner Udaly got it exactly right. This is a clarification of the restrictions we put in place as a result of the executive order. We saw an increase in the number of federal agents here in our city. That led to an increase in escalation. The governor and her team negotiated a withdrawal of the federal presence here in the city of Portland. I appreciated the partnership that we put into place with the governor. Now that the large federal presence has abated, it's up to us to ensure that they don't come back. And so it requires us to be able to communicate with those local federal officers who live here, who work here, who are staged in that facility on a daily basis. We need to have communications with them in order to ensure that we're coordinated and that there is no opportunity for the president to send more of a federal presence back to our city. That's what this is about. I support it. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. The resolution, I'm sorry, it's a resolution. The resolution is adopted. Next item is the regular agenda, item 661, emergency ordinance.
Authorize a temporary interfund loan not to exceed $3,500,000 from the Housing Investment Fund to the Housing Development Costs and the Grants Funds to fund program requirements on affordable housing projects.
Colleagues, the purpose of this legislation is to provide temporary funding from the Housing Investment Fund to the Housing Development Costs Fund and the Grants Fund in a total amount of $3,500,000. Of this amount, $2,500,000 will be loaned to the Housing Development Costs Fund and $1 million to the Grants Fund in anticipation of city bond proceeds in fiscal year 2021 and grants from the Metro Affordable Housing Projects, which are expected to be received no later than December 31st, 2021. Bridget O'Callaghan is here and present to answer any questions. Bridget, welcome.
Hello, Mayor and Council. For the record, my name is Bridget O'Callaghan and I'm the City Treasurer. Also joining me today will be Mike Johnson from the Portland Housing Bureau, who will be available to answer any questions about the request itself. As you've stated, the purpose of this legislation is to provide temporary funding in the form of two interfund loans from the Housing Investment Fund to the Housing Development Cost Fund and the Housing Grants Fund in a total amount of $3.5 million. The It will be structured as two loans, the first in the amount of $2,500,000 to the Housing Development Cost Fund in anticipation of the city bond proceeds that will be received in fiscal year 2021, and the second loan in the amount of $1 million to the Housing Grants Fund in anticipation of grants from the Metro Affordable Housing Projects expected to be received no later than December 31st, 2021. Background, in 2026, the Portland voters voted to issue $258.4 million in general obligation bonds to fund and finance capital projects for affordable housing. And in 2018, Portland area voters voted and approved the issuance of $652.8 million of general obligation bonds by Metro, also to finance the capital costs of affordable housing projects for low-income households in the Portland area. A portion of those Metro bond funds will also be granted to the city. These loans will essentially address a timing issue between when the Housing Bureau will need to spend the funds and when they can be reimbursed for those expenditures. So the Housing Bureau is currently working on financing for 10 City of Portland affordable housing projects and will soon begin preparation on the phase two project work under the Metro bond program. The Housing Bureau plans to be reimbursed for affordable housing capital project costs through project fees. Those fees are associated with both of these bond projects. However, the fee income will not be available until the projects are under construction. And the Bureau is currently incurring costs for pre-development and pre-construction at this time. The loan will permit the Housing Bureau to move forward with these multi-year affordable housing projects in accordance with budget law. The loan to the Housing Development Cost Fund will be repaid no later than June 30th, 2021, and the loan to the Grants Fund will be repaid no later than December 31st, 2021, and the loans will be repaid with interest at the rate of the city's current investment rate portfolio. So it's, if you will, a neutral economic impact to the Bureau. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
It looks like Commissioner Udaly, but I think that's probably from last time. Commissioner Udaly, is that, do you have your hand up or is that just from the last item? Is there any public testimony on this item, Carla?
No one registered, Mayor.
Very good. This is an emergency ordinance. We have no further questions. Please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Thank you for the presentation. Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you. Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next item is 662.
Authorize intergovernmental agreement with Metro to receive bond proceeds and implement Portland's local implementation strategy to satisfy Metro's regional housing bond goals and requirements.
All right, colleagues. In November of 2018, Portland voters approved Metro Ballot Measure 26199. As you'll recall, that created $652.8 million in GO bonds, general obligation bonds, to fund affordable housing in the Tri-County Metro region, including the City of Portland. The authorization of this intergovernmental agreement allows the Portland Housing Bureau to receive bond funds in the form of a grant and implement Portland's local implementation strategy, which outlines how funds will be invested to meet the ballot measure's goals and requirements here in the City of Portland. As one of Metro's local implementation partners, Portland will receive $211 million of total bond proceeds to develop 1,475 units of affordable housing for households earning up to 60% of AMI. And I know that Commissioner Hardesty will ask, so I will say that is equal to $38,700 for an individual and $55,260 for a family of four. Our local implementation strategy is in alignment with Council's overarching goals and values related to affordable housing, and it highlights priorities for deeply affordable units, supportive housing units, as well as family size units. We have Director Callahan here and the team from the Portland Housing Bureau here to present. Director Callahan, I see you there somewhere. I see you.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Shannon Callahan of the Portland Housing Bureau, and I'll be joined in the presentation by Molly Rogers, our Housing Bureau Deputy Director. And as you indicated, Mayor, we are here to ask for Council's approval on the intergovernmental agreement with Metro to facilitate the Metro Regional Bond. Next slide, please, Molly. As you mentioned, Metro has a regional bond with the intent to create 3,900 units of affordable homes within the region.
Hey, Shannon, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Maybe it's just me, but it looks like your presentation, we're only seeing like half of it. It's too big to fit in the screen. Can you shrink it a little bit?
Okay. I will see what we can do.
I mean, it's not a huge deal. Why don't you go on and Molly will muck around with it.
I will tell you that that trying to do Zoom and screen sharing is mastered.
It's a pain in the rear. I get it. Just maybe as you give the presentation, if Molly could work on it.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I think it's you, Mayor.
Yeah, it usually is.
Wonderful.
Unless the sticky notes were not supposed to be part of your presentation.
No, I don't believe we're supposed to be sharing sticky notes.
There was a screen and then there was a half a screen with sticky notes on it. So maybe it's just...
Interesting. That is not what I am seeing, but I guess the mysteries of Zoom abound. So... So, Molly, Metro's goals are to create 3,900 new units of affordable housing within the region, 1,600 of which will be affordable at 30% AMI. They also have a goal to reach 1,950 family-sized units. And Metro, in contrast to what the housing bond in Portland did, allows a small percentage of affordable units to be programmed from 60 to 80% of area median income. Next slide, if you could, Molly. I'm not sure what everyone can see. Metro, when they referred the bond, did establish priority communities for us to focus a housing to be built and or acquired with. Those priority communities are, as indicated by Metro, communities of color, families with children and multiple generations, people living with disabilities, seniors, veterans, and households experiencing homelessness and or imminent displacement. Molly, if you wouldn't mind trying the slide. Metro has made initial progress with their housing bond, including one early, what's called phase one project within the city limits of Portland. That is Deakum Court, which will bring 160 new units of affordable housing with the project partner Home Forward to Northeast Portland. Molly, could you slide ahead? And with that, I'd like to go through just quickly what the allocation is for the City of Portland and what the goals that we are trying to achieve. Hopefully, can you all see the slides now? Is it working or are you still seeing Post-it notes?
It's good enough. I don't see any Post-it
notes. There's still a corner cracked off, but it's all right.
Okay. So as you can see by the slide in front of you, the total allocation within the City of Portland is $211 million. Deakum Court has already been granted funding in $23 million for their project. And the IGA that you're considering today deals with the $188 million remaining. And the goals that we need to achieve with those funds are 1,315 total units, 539 below or 30% AMI, as the mayor has already indicated to you what that is, and then 657 family size units. I wanted to pause. Yep.
Excuse me, Shannon, can you tell me what a family size unit is?
So according to what Metro has asked us to program, that would mean family size units would be two bedrooms and above. The emphasis that we've been asked by the community and through our implementation strategy is to try to achieve larger bedroom size than 2-bedroom that can accommodate families of multiple generations or larger families. So working to also program 3- and 4-bedroom units where we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. So just briefly an overview of the IGA itself. Metro is providing up to 2.1% administrative and staff support to local jurisdictions. Metro is retaining $23 million in funds for a land acquisition program within the city of Portland and or at Metro's discretion to provide gap financing. Metro is requiring us to maintain 60-year affordability covenants on all of the properties. As you may recall, the city of Portland already requires 99 years, so this is not a challenge for us. The Housing Bureau, in cooperation with the city, will select the projects, but approval for funding is at Metro's sole discretion. And now I'd like to turn it over to Molly to talk a little bit more about how we plan to implement the Metro bond.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm pleased to share with you how we developed our local implementation strategy. And it really started really actually with the Portland Housing Bond and the work we did over a 9-month period to develop that framework, engaged with over 1,000 community members across 16 different linguistic groups. And we gathered that work at that time and we built our strategies then. That work really paid off. Within a 2-year period, we've been able to deliver on the goals of the Portland Bond, and we wanted to build from there. We also recognized that there were some areas and some vulnerable communities we wanted to do some deeper dives and some additional outreach with, particularly with our immigrant community and our disability communities. We did some additional outreach and co-sponsored some focus groups out with other jurisdictional partners in Southwest Portland, North and Northeast, and East Portland. And what we did is we collated all of this work into a compilation of themes to help inform our goals, strategies, and approaches, which I'm going to get to in just a second. We really had to use many venues to do this engagement work, and we started with surveys that were conducted by community engagement liaisons, and they were able to engage with 11 different cultural communities through 88 different surveys that were completed. We did focus groups in East Portland, and we were able to do that because this is a regional measure. City of Gresham and Multnomah County also received some funds, and we wanted to look at some where we could collaborate with those other jurisdictional partners. And we engaged with 30 individuals out in East Portland to do that. We engaged with over 100 individuals in different feedback sessions across about a dozen different advisory and oversight committees across the city, including the Neighborhood Prosperity Network, our North and Northeast Portland Oversight Committees, and Southwest Corridor Community Advisory Committee members. And we also spent some time with the coordinator of the city's commission on disabilities, and we did some specific outreach to people with disabilities or those representing disability rights, and wanted to get specific input on how do we advance housing for folks who have disabilities. The themes that really emerge through all this engagement work is, yes, we need to do a better job of doing outreach to immigrant and refugee communities. Overwhelmingly, we heard from folks that they want to know when the next housing opportunities are coming up. They have an opportunity to apply and they need a better sense of how they get through the application process. We were asked to get more clear and measurable goals for equity, which I will describe in a few moments. We did hear from partners. They wanted not us just to focus on rental housing, but also homeownership opportunities, especially as we know that this is a key strategy for households of color to increase generational wealth. We were asked to continue supporting our goal for 2,000 units of supportive housing through this measure. And that that we will work clearly need to work with the joint office and other partners in figuring out the assembly of resources that it will take to do that. But we're looking to set a goal for supportive housing with Metro funds as well. Key strategy in how we're going to achieve the 30% unit production goals is really ensuring we have rent or operating support to do that. People are very rent burdened, and even in affordable housing, and being able to have additional rent support means that those really low, extremely low-income households are not rent burdened. And last but not least, really keep honing in on we need more access through into affordable housing through low barrier screening. So part of our leading with racial equity was a principle, guiding principle in the development of our bond framework. And of course, PHB shares in that value. We work to advance racial equity for BIPOC communities and households to reduce barriers to housing and outcomes. We want to increase economic opportunities for certified businesses, and we are looking to facilitate culturally specific partnerships so we can deepen our connection with marginalized populations. We are striving to increase services for residents of affordable housing to access culturally specific services, and we asked our stakeholders how to help us create these strategies to advance racial equity for our Metro bond work. What we heard was we need to deepen our outreach and engagement work. We need to listen to community members and associations with linkages to marginalized communities. We need to communicate in more languages, and we need to think about culturally specific project design and outreach plans. And we're asked to do more facilitating of partnerships between affordable housing developers and minority-owned businesses, contractors, professional services, and culturally specific providers. We're also looking to look at project selection. We also heard we need to select project partners who have a demonstrated commitment to racial equity. So we've seen greater weight is placed on our team's equity plans. We're looking to corroborate that with track record data on those developers, on their past projects, and how they have achieved construction and professional services percents in certified contracting. And when I say certified, I'm really meaning disadvantaged, minority, women-owned, and emerging small businesses with small or end service disabled veteran certifications. The city's goal for DMWSB contracting is 20%. But PHB has set a higher goal of 30% for construction contracting. And we will ask our development partners to achieve a 30% goal in our Metro-funded projects, just like we did for our Portland bond-funded projects. Our selection committees for the Portland bond-funded projects last year was majority.
Can I stop you for one second? I want to make sure Commissioner Hardesty, I'm sorry, I thought that was a residual hand up. Commissioner
Hardesty. No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Molly. Molly, you're on a roll. I'm sorry to interrupt, but my question really has to do with the DMWESB SDV recommendations that you're putting in place. Let me first say that I'm thrilled that you're setting a higher goal and higher aspirational goal of 30%. I think what I heard you say was that you're not just gonna take the developer's word. What you're gonna do is look at how they performed in the past. Is that an accurate statement?
That is correct. What we do, we work with Kathleen Messier to track the progress on a continuous basis of all the projects that we fund. and we look at the progression over the course of the construction of the, all those projects. Right. And what we do notice is the more we track the data and we publicly share that data, the more we've seen increased results and outcomes, particularly in construction.
It's shocking, Molly, that you publicly report, the better the outcomes are. How amazing that is. I appreciate that very thorough commitment, because honestly, I think the Bureau of Purchasing should also be raising their aspirational goals as well. And we're never, ever, ever going to achieve equity and construction if we aren't absolutely committed to gathering the data and publicizing it on a regular basis. But on the other end, so let's say a developer does not achieve the aspirational goal. Are we required to contract with them anyway?
Well, that will certainly affect their ability to seek funding for future projects. Once a project's under construction, there's not a whole lot we can do. That's why the continuous tracking through the course of that whatever 2-year period is really key. What we've done is actually dedicated some of the bond resources to technical assistance to actually fund housing navigators to work with each of our teams to help connect them with subcontractors and other professional services that are certified.
I'm very interested in the results that you obtained from that, because I think that could very well be a model for us moving forward as we looked at how we contract at the city anyway. But it is a good plan, and I will be monitoring it as you are monitoring it as we move forward. Thank you. That was very helpful.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just last but not least, just want to mention that really one of the key strategies we've seen to increase the number of BIPOC households accessing affordable housing is really through culturally specific partnerships and direct referrals into that housing. We've seen an unprecedented number of new partnerships in the last couple of years between culturally specific agencies and affordable housing providers. And we really hope to see those partnerships deepen and create some systemic change.
And so that means you've expanded the number of BIPOC community partners over the last few years?
I believe so. Interestingly enough, we actually have an RFI on the street right now to engage with even more culturally specific agencies to work with us in our CARES funding. And we want to continue seeing more and more BIPOC households accessing the resources that we're putting resources into.
As do we. Thank you.
With the local implementation strategy for Metro, we did adopt additional goals for Portland. I can't emphasize this enough, but we need to continue to build more supportive housing for chronically homeless individuals and families. And we have set a goal to develop 2,000 of supportive housing units by 2028 between the city and the county. This does depend on additional resources from the joint office and the Metro homelessness measure, but we want to put out a goal of 300 supportive housing units through the Metro housing bond. We also are looking to, we did hear that even though Portland's code and our policies are really specific to 60% and below area median income affordability, there may be some exceptions to that to that 60%, and we may look at only on an exception basis doing some at 80% area median income affordability in a way to mitigate displacement, and particularly when we have sometimes developers acquiring existing market rate units and they want to convert it into affordable. We don't necessarily want that in itself to create a displacing event. We want to be able to have people stay in their homes if possible and or allow people to increase their income over time. So no more than 10% of the total amount of units developed would be between 60 to 80% of area median income.
Why is this? Why would we not want to have more deeply affordable units? 80% really does not address the folks who are desperately looking for housing they can afford. Why so few at 60% to 30% MFI as compared to 80%?
Well, the maximum would be 10% of the total units could be between up to 80, but half of them are meant to be, no, I'm sorry, 41% are meant to be at 30% of your median income. So the, we're-
40% at 30? Is that what you said?
The 40%. Unit production target. Sorry, I'm coughing.
That's okay.
We're the 41% of the total units are going to be affordable at 30% of your median income.
And is that the units that the city of Portland are building, or is that region wide?
That's actually region wide. And that's going to be what we adopt as well.
So I guess I'm just unclear. Are 80% of the units, I mean, I'm sorry, 80% of AMI a part of this proposal? So we got 100% of the units, you said, what? I forget what the total number is that we're going to build. And 80%, I'm sorry, if 80% of AMI is going to be what percentage of the units?
No more than 10%.
No more than 10% will be at 80%. And the goal is to have 40% at 30% or lower. Is that accurate?
41, yeah. 41% at 30%. Yeah, it's a little bit confusing.
No, I'm trying to track it. I'm trying to keep track. Okay, no, that's good. That, because I had it mixed up in my mind that the most would be at 80%. And I just think that 80% doesn't do enough to make housing units affordable at all. Because that's, you still have to make $72,000 to be able to afford a 80% AMI unit.
And we agree with you, Commissioner. We want to see as much deeply affordable units built with this with these resources as possible. Metro allowed some small percentage to be higher than 60, but that's in our for Portland, we're only looking at that as an exception basis, not a not something that we would go to, and only in cases where we would mitigate displacement.
Excellent. Thank you.
And we did hear from community members that some portion of the funds would be nice to support homeownership. And like I mentioned before, we were looking to seek a 30% construction goal for DMW ESB participation. We're looking at three phases of implementation. One, we're actually already, that's already been approved by Metro because it's their resources. They had initially approved about $23 million going towards Deakin Court, which is currently a public housing project of 40 units up at Northeast. And the redevelopment plan will actually end up being 200 units, but 160 new units that will be supported by Metro funding. And that work is already underway, and they're hoping to do a groundbreaking in 2021. Our second phase is looking at PHB's current pipeline and really leveraging those projects that have already received some level of funding commitments, but not all the commitments that they need to actually reach financial close. So this will be the last money in to get those projects over the finish line to get to be able to start construction. And these four projects, if we can make it all work, would increase significantly our housing opportunities in East Portland as well as in South Waterfront, and it could be about a 330 units that we would like to see get funded in fall and winter of 2020. Our next phase, Shannon is going to talk about our last phase.
Thank you, Molly. Thank you, commissioners. The next phase of our work with the Metro Regional Bond is planned. First and foremost, we need to work with our partners at the Joint Office of Multnomah County and Metro to negotiate and secure rent and supportive services funding. The Metro bond, when initially passed by voters, did not contain commitments to help us achieve that 41% of deeply affordable units that Molly had just mentioned. In Multnomah County, we did not have available vouchers to be able to support a portion of that work. And so the Here Together ballot measure was extremely instrumental for us in being able to have a resource to move forward to complete our shared goals under the Metro Regional Bond. So please know that we'll be beginning those negotiations very quickly after you adopt this IGA. We then plan to release a Metro Bond opportunity solicitation, really specifically to reach those targets around supportive housing that we all need to work to achieve to ensure that we're housing folks with needs and getting people out of shelters and off the streets and into permanent supportive housing. And then finally, another chunk of our work is going to be on the first phase of the Broadway Corridor. As we've talked about with council and the community in the past, it's very important for the Housing Bureau, Prosper Portland, and all of our partners to make sure that we are developing affordable housing in the first phase of development with the Broadway Corridor. So that gives you a brief snapshot of the next steps to look forward to from the Housing Bureau. We appreciate your time this morning and would ask for your support in approving this IGA. Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent presentation. Is there any other question before we open this up for public testimony? Carla, how many people do we have signed up for public testimony?
No one registered for this item, Mayor.
Very good. This is emergency ordinance. Please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Thank you, Molly and Shannon, for an excellent presentation. Thank you very much for increasing the opportunity for minority and women contractors as you move forward with this work. Looks like an excellent plan. I look forward to continuing to work with you to make sure that we realize all the goals that we put into this plan. I'm happy to vote aye.
Udaley?
I thank you for the presentation. I strongly support this work moving forward. We're making historic investments in affordable housing, and I really appreciate the work of the Portland Housing Bureau to make it happen. That being said, as we saw with these numbers, we're still only getting to a fraction of the existing need in affordable housing. I want to just quickly say that I am very happy to see that we are focusing the majority of our funds on housing for below 80% of MFI. I strongly support as much housing at 60 and under as possible, because I think we can incentivize private developers in the 60 to 80% realm. Also supportive housing, home ownership opportunities, and anti-displacement being expressed priorities, I really appreciate. I want to just voice on the record my grave concern about the impact of COVID-19 on Portland's housing stock and market as we move forward. We are, if the state and federal government do not act to avert the wave of evictions and foreclosures that's coming, we're throwing the doors open wide to predatory Wall Street investors to buy up hundreds or thousands of distressed property in our city, which will only serve to exacerbate our existing housing crisis. So I really want to emphasize the importance of us creating some kind of affordable housing acquisition fund so that we don't see naturally occurring affordable housing become extinct in our city. Again, thank you for all your work, and thank you, voters, for passing this. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for the very thorough presentation and for all your good work. Aye.
Wheeler.
Excellent work. Thank you. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next up is 663.
Okay, if I get Molly to stop sharing that screen, thank you. 663, approve application under the multiple unit limited tax exemption program under the inclusionary housing program for Vibrant Cities Fargo, located at 25 North Fargo Street.
Very good. All right, you all know the drill. We'll hear now from, is Dory giving the presentation or Cassie, are you doing it today?
I'm doing it today.
All right, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. Thank you for having me this morning, almost afternoon. So Vibrant City Fargo, it's a 100-unit mixed-use market rate development. You're seeing this project here today because Multi is one of the financial incentives provided to buildings who are subject to inclusionary housing who choose to provide the IH units within their building. The Multi is a 10-year property tax exemption on the IH units and the applicable percentage of shared residential space. This particular project chose the first IH option, which is restricting 15%, or in this building's case, 15 units, at 80% MFI for 99 years. Those units are comprised of 8 studios, 6 1-bedrooms, and 1 2-bedroom. Does anyone have any questions?
Any questions, colleagues?
Mayor, I have a question.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. Thank you, Cassie. My question has to do with, do you know the square footage of the 2-bedroom units, and are they the same for the market rate as they are for the 15 units that will be at 80%?
Yeah. So the average square footage of all of the 2-bedroom units is 583 square feet. I do have the minimum square footage, which is 90% of that. I'd have to pull up the, I do have it, I think, the plan review set to see if they have any 2-bedrooms, if they're all the same. And I just have it up right now, so thank you for your patience. So it looks like the minimum square footage that they would provide is 524 based on regulations, which is 90%, but the smallest unit that they have is 574 square feet. So it's about 12 square foot difference between their smallest 2-bedroom and their largest 2-bedroom.
Is there a legal definition of what a bedroom is?
So in zoning code, there is not a definition of a bedroom, but we do have a definition of what constitutes a bedroom. And we also distinguish between different bedroom types, like windowed or windowless.
Right.
So in a situation where you'd have a bedroom within a unit that has no windows or like sliding doors to the outside, we consider that a windowless unit. So if a building has windowless units and windowed units, we actually consider those two distinct different types. So they have to provide an equal percentage of each.
Yeah, I'm just very concerned that we're squeezing people into very tiny spaces and we are calling it affordable, and it's not quite affordable for folks who actually are working 2 and 3 minimum wage jobs. So I appreciate the fact that the city has a definition. I think we may want to reevaluate that definition, because if we're giving people tax breaks to provide housing that will be affordable for 99 years, I am very concerned that we are not maximizing the square footage that would be available for families. I mean, a 2-bedroom is one thing, but as soon as you get to a 3-bedroom, and I've seen some of these multis with 600 square feet for a 3-bedroom, which seems insane to me. And I know we will be evaluating whether or not this program is worth what we've invested in it as far as time and energy and resources at a later date. But thank you for the answer to that question. It would be helpful if you would include that information in the materials that come to us, because I find myself always having to ask about the square footage and whether or not there's a difference between what we're calling affordable and what the market rate is. So thank you, Cassie. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Cassie, does that complete your presentation today?
Yes, if there's no other questions.
Very good. Carla, are there, well, first of all, ask my colleagues, any other questions? Carla, any public testimony?
No one signed up for this one.
Very good. This is an emergency ordinance. Please call the roll.
Hardesty.
I continue to wonder about whether or not what we get as far as our return on this multi-program. I know we're going to be doing an evaluation later. I'm hoping that it will be early enough to inform us as we continue to move forward with this program. I am concerned about whether or not we are really making life easier or harder for people who are low income in these multi-buildings. When you have 100 units and 15 are supposedly affordable, the building is not built for the folks who need affordable units. And I would say 80% is still not affordable, but that's just me personally. So I will vote yes for this, but I will continue to question the logic of this particular program and whether or not the return we get is worth all the grief we go through to provide this opportunity to developers. I vote aye.
Daly?
Well, thanks for the presentation. I like your Cliff House photos behind you. I love that place. excuse me. I'm also always interested if we're getting a good value for what we're giving. But the trend really is toward smaller apartments. And while I would prefer to see no difference between an affordable unit and a market rate unit, 12 square feet is not unacceptable to me. A micro apartment is defined as anything under 350 square feet. So 500 plus is not tiny. It'd be too small for me. Thank you, and I vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for the presentation. Aye.
Wheeler.
Good job, Cassie. So this Vibrant Cities Fargo, it brings the total number of private sector buildings in the inclusionary housing permit approval pipeline to 95. So we're closing in on that 100 number. That now makes a minimum of 673 units less expensive than what they would be if these were market-driven apartments. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Thank you. Next item is 664, Bureau of Transportation Non-Emergency Ordinance.
Assess benefited properties for street, sidewalk, stormwater, water main and sanitary sewer improvements in the Southwest 45th Avenue and California Street Local Improvement District.
Commissioner Daly.
Thank you, Mayor. This local improvement district was first authorized about 6 years ago. PBOT has fulfilled its end of the bargain, and now it's time for us to assess the property and begin collecting the funds. It's my understanding that the originators of the LID, St. Luke's Lutheran Church, has submitted an objection to the methodology used to assess the amount owed. I welcome their testimony today, and I'll be asking some follow-up questions of staff and Lindley Reese, our city attorney, present today to make sure we are clear about the city's position. Just a reminder that there will not be a vote today, so if the rest of council has additional questions or concerns after the hearing, we will be happy to follow up with you before we bring it back for a final vote. But first, here to give us details on the history of this LID and answer any initial questions is our esteemed local improvement district coordinator, Andrew Abbey. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Udaly. Andrew Abbey, local improvement district administrator. I'm going to show council a brief slide presentation in a moment. Before I do that, I noticed that when the ordinance went over to the council clerk's office, that three exhibits were missing labels. So I just wanted to respectfully move an amendment that we add three exhibit labels. The first one is to add an exhibit label that breaks out the $1,133,000 in cost. The second label is for exhibit C to break out the $438,000 in contractor construction cost. And then the third label is for Exhibit E, which apportions the $819,000 in LID costs. So if I could respectfully request the commissioner to move that amendment and take a vote on it, then I'll move on to the presentation.
I was going to do that after your presentation, but so moved. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you.
Commissioner Daly moves. Commissioner Hardesty seconds. Do you want us to vote now, Commissioner Hardesty, and put that on?
I'm Commissioner Hardesty. That's a
Commissioner. I'm sorry, Commissioner Daly. Do you want us to vote on that now or hold this off until after public
testimony? Let's just take the vote now. Get it out of the way.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner Daly. Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. Amendments adopted.
Thank you very much. Gayla, I know I was going to advance the slide presentation, but for whatever reason, it's not popping up on my screen here. So I'm going to ask you to go ahead and advance it for me, okay? All right. So the first slide that we're looking at here, go back to that second slide. Go to slide number two, please. Thank you very much. So as Commissioner Udaly mentioned, we introduced the item. This has been a long, complex project. It's been a very good project. This project really started with a street vacation 10 years ago in 2010 and is inextricably intertwined with not only an original street vacation, but also an amended street vacation. You can see from this timeline that we wrapped up contractor construction 3 years ago in 2017. And then last fall, we wrapped up an additional pavement grind and inlay. That work was done by PBOT at no cost to the LID. And here we are in August 2020, 10 years later, with final assessment of the LID. Slide number three, please, Gayla. So this is just a map of the LID area. So the green circle is the actual area of improvement in the LID. One of the really positive things about this project is that when we started the LID, Maplewood was dead last among all the neighborhoods in Portland for its ratio of sidewalk coverage. So when we started the LID, Maplewood had only 4.5% sidewalk coverage. With the completion of this LID and some additional sidewalk improvements that have occurred, it's now up to 5.8%. So Maplewood is no longer in last place and is inching just a little bit closer to that citywide average of 62.7% sidewalk coverage. Slide number four, please. So the other really beneficial aspect of this project from a systemic point of view is that we have now extended sidewalk coverage all the way from the Hillsdale Town Center to west of the LID area. So, you know, Southwest Portland is well known for having gaps in sidewalk connectivity, but Vermont Street now has a really good sidewalk connection all the way from Hillsdale to west of where the LID area is. Slide number five, please. So this is an area at the former Southwest 46 and Florida intersection. So when we started this LID, St. Luke Church had an obligation to improve Southwest 46th Avenue that went through this area. There was also an obligation to improve Southwest Florida Street. PBOT didn't think it made sense to try to put through a street in an environmental protection zone area. So a real benefit of this project was to remove Southwest 46th Avenue and Florida Street from a requirement that otherwise would have been placed on St. Luke to build street improvements. One of the key things that this LID did, and we knew this going into the LID, is that there were sanitary sewer deficiencies in this area. And so we were able to take advantage of the opportunity to extend sanitary sewer and no longer have septic tanks in the area of this environmental protection zone. Slide number six, please. This is a picture of Southwest 45th Avenue before we started the LID. So we had no sidewalks on the west side of the street. You can see that TriMet bus coming up the street. You can see somebody trying to back into a gravel shoulder parking space. There's literally no place for pedestrians to walk here. Slide number seven, please. And this is an after picture of Southwest 45th Avenue. You can see the picture there on the left, right after we poured that new sidewalk. The picture on the right is 3 years later, just on the other side of California Street, looking north, where we were able to use those, we were able to leverage those PBOT maintenance operations funds to then come in after we had Swiss cheese and the pavement of Southwest 45th Avenue. And as I mentioned, at no cost to the LID, we were able to put a nice paving overlay and then restripe Southwest 45th Avenue. That concludes my PowerPoint presentation before I turn it over to property owner testimony. I did kind of want to walk through an additional benefit of the LID that I did not include in the PowerPoint presentation. So by building the sidewalk infrastructure, we were able to work with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to do a zoning upgrade. So the area of the LID along Southwest 45th Avenue on the west side, but also the east side of Southwest 46th Avenue, most of that used to be zoned R7. We were able to get that upgraded to RM2 zoning because we were building the sidewalk infrastructure. So the net result of that is that 83,151 square feet of property area was added to the RM2 zone. Of that, 34,317 square feet is area currently owned by St. Luke, and 48,834 square feet is owned by Gabriel 45 LLC. That is a 41.3% and 58.7% split. If you look at the area of RM2 upzone that is outside of the exempted P zone area, the total area that we added to the LID that is add development potential to those properties is 81,248 square feet, of which 32,414 square feet is St. Luke, and 48,834 square feet is Gabriel 45 LLC, for a split of 39.9% and 60.1%. So I just wanted to add in that additional development potential benefit, and happy to turn it over to property owner testimony and answer any questions that council might have.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it. Are there any other questions right at this moment? Carla, how many individuals are signed up for public testimony?
We have one person, Joan Snyder.
All right, Joan, you're up.
Can you hear me?
Yep, you're good to go.
Thank you. Commissioners Udaly, Fritz, and Hardesty, and Mayor Wheeler, thank you for this opportunity to speak on this issue. I am Joan Snyder, and I'm speaking on behalf of St. Luke Lutheran Church of Portland, which is one of two property owners that will be subject to this lit assessment. I want to focus here on four things: community, fairness, legal process, and transparency. St. Luke Church is all about community. My shorthand explanation always for our church is that we are a social justice striving, environmentally active, roll up our sleeves and service kind of church. So from the perspective of community, I applaud everything that Mr. Abbey just said. St. Luke is pleased that this LID brought in street, sidewalk, and stormwater improvements that the Southwest community wanted and deserved. And so that we're just very pleased with the outcome of the LID construction. But my second point is fairness. As set forth in our written testimony, St. Luke thinks it's substantively unfair to us assess us 76.7% of the cost of these improvements based on a square foot methodology. I've gone into this more in my written materials, but let me explain it here in the context of stormwater improvements, which were a large part of the work. Most of the St. Luke property, as you could see from, I think, that second slide that Mr. Abbey put up, is interior to the streets. And St. Luke itself has already done the extensive and expensive work to address the stormwater that is generated on that property. So prior to this whole project, in the course of grading our back parking lot, we installed very extensive vegetated swales, which I think far exceed what you see even now in most properties in Portland, including business properties. Our environmental committee separately installed a stormwater swale on our California Street property. And then, as part of this building project, our permit required and we did additional very extensive stormwater work, including at least three more constructed stormwater swales, might have been four. And then notably, in terms of public benefit, we added a very large, taking up a large amount of our property, vegetated infiltration basin on our Vermont Street property to address not only our stormwater, but city street stormwater. We specifically entered into an agreement with the city that it could divert overflow from the Vermont Street stormwater swales it was installing into our infiltration basin, and we have the obligation to maintain it. So we've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to address the stormwater being generated on the interior of our parcels, which takes me to the issue of fairness. We believe it would be fair to assess St. Luke and the other property owners in the LID on a linear frontage basis for the additional street-focused stormwater improvements, but that it would be unfair to assess us on a square footage basis when we have had to assume that all the cost of all the improvements for the interior portion of those properties. So the LID is providing the benefit of linear street-related stormwater services, but we're being charged as if it benefited the entire parcel. And our written materials go further into that same issue with respect to sidewalks and street improvements. Third, on the issue of legal process, I know I don't have time to go far into this issue, but it's addressed in our written testimony. The city code and state law say that city council has the obligation at this time, at the time of the final assessment ordinance, to look at the relative benefits being provided to properties being assessed under the LID. And that code says the city has no authority to enter into any agreements that negate the deed for that determination. And my fourth issue is transparency. Our written testimony addresses the ways that this process lacked transparency for St. Luke, including that we found out for the first time a week before this hearing that the city had entered into agreements with the second LID party, which at least that party contends controls the outcome of this hearing. We think that the city should determine how to address transparency going forward. It particularly, this may be a narrow circumstance, but our circumstance where we entered into the LID as a single payer LID, and then the LID was amended without our knowledge to add another payer without any conversation. We think it just would have been tremendously helpful if when the second party joined the LID in 2015, the city had told us that was going to happen and held a meeting between the two property owners at that time. We could have discussed the additional scope of work, cost estimates, and see whether there could be an agreement between those parties on an apportionment approach.
That's 3 minutes.
Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, appreciate it. Colleagues, any further discussion on this matter? Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you for the testimony. We just received your voluminous document last night or this morning, so I haven't had a chance to review it, and I don't know that Andrew Abbey has as well, has either. Andrew, do you have any comments just preliminarily? I appreciate that Commissioner Udaly said that we're not voting till next week, so we can get a more thorough analysis, but if you could give us, if you have any comments, I'd be interested to hear.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator. I don't think I need to get into the details of, you know, all of the discussion items. I can certainly follow up with council between now and next Wednesday, but I would like to, if I may, just make a few very basic points. So a couple of things. We were fully transparent on this LID. So the LID petition that was signed by St. Luke just had in it the square footage assessment methodology. And as a matter of fact, if you look at Exhibit F, Attachment 3, you will see that St. Luke actually put together the LID, so to speak, and that they did not want their neighbors to be assessed. In theory, we could have had a conversation prior to petitioning the LID about asking their neighbors to pay more than what we're currently charging, but the LID basically carried out what St. Luke asked me to carry out in 2014. That was reflected in the LID petition, it was reflected in the resolution approved by council, and it was reflected in the LID formation ordinance. The additional extra work agreement that was negotiated with the adjoining property owner was done under delegated authority that was included in the formation ordinance. This is, I just want to make two really basic points that I think is important for council to understand. In no circumstance would I recommend an abutting linear footage methodology. Of the costs that are proposed to be assessed, $129,302 is for water main improvements. The benefit of those water main improvements was is that the St. Luke Sanctuary that was recently remodeled now has been brought into fire code compliance. If we were to adopt an abutting linear footage methodology, that particular property would be completely exempt from assessment, even though it significantly benefited from those water main improvements. And then lastly, what I just wanted to say is that I read through the testimony that St. Luke sent yesterday. They are asking to pay as little as 45% of the LID, which translates into about $376,000. If you look at the cost of the water main improvements and then look at the engineering cost, the St. Luke assessment that they are proposing would barely cover the cost of the water main improvements and the engineering costs that were driven by having to coordinate with St. Luke when they were doing their site development improvements, and wouldn't even begin to charge St. Luke for the actual other infrastructure improvements that were constructed beyond the water main improvements. So in closing, I just want to tell council that I feel very comfortable that this is a fair assessment methodology. And as I mentioned earlier at the tail end of the slide presentation, St. Luke has received future development potential from the RM2 up zone. So my respectful recommendation to council is to not amend the LID formation ordinance other than the amendment that's already been made. And in closing, I do want to say that notwithstanding the objection to final assessment, it has been a distinct privilege to work with St. Luke, and they are a wonderful community partner, and I appreciate the opportunity to have worked on the project with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, first I want to thank Joan Snyder for coming today and giving testimony, and just thank the St. Luke's Church for their stewardship of this land and service to our community. This is an interesting situation. I also want to thank Andrew Abbey for his hard work on this. This LID predates not only my guidance of PBOT, but my term on city council. So he's been working on this for a long time. I deeply trust and respect your work. And I'm going to ask a couple questions, and it may be that they're more appropriate for Lindley, but Andrew, if you do want to weigh in, feel free. I think I understand your explanation of the methodology and why abutting linear footage wouldn't be appropriate. That makes sense to me. What I don't know is why the church initially didn't want the adjacent property owner to pay into the LID. Typically, all benefiting property owners would be participants who would contribute. And I guess if there's any precedent of a situation like this where we've agreed on the terms and then ownership of involved property changes and we have to go back and amend after the fact, I imagine it would be problematic to amend since the new property owner didn't participate in the formation of the LID or agree to any of the terms at the outset. So any thoughts on that?
So Andrew, I'll jump in on your second question, Commissioner.
Okay.
In terms of the formation methodology and whether you could add additional property owners at this late date, the answer is not really, unless you go back and reform the district. I mean, you essentially have steps set forth both in state statute and in our code where you have a resolution of intent. You then have a formation hearing for which you have notice, an opportunity to remonstrate, and a hearing. And then once the project is completed, you come back and you assess, and our code requires that it be based on the formation, the assessment methodology you adopted at formation. So without, you know, starting afresh and giving notice and an opportunity to remonstrate, you really couldn't change the assessment methodology. So I think
and that- the other challenge is the work has already been done and the city has footed the bill. So
yeah.
So I guess my remaining kind of concern or sticking point is that should we have revisited the LID with all of the parties when that change in ownership happened? Because now when it's completely after the fact, there's not a lot we can do other than.
So Commissioner, I think what's really important to understand is that when I started my discussions with St. Luke, they were dead in the water with their street vacation, and they were not on track to getting their permit to do the first phase of their capital campaign. So this situation was entirely foreseeable. Anybody could look at this small house next door on a very large lot and see that at some point it was going to be developed. But I respectfully submit that this was a business decision that was made, that there's a difference in timing of development. St. Luke and the next door property at some point were going to be developed. St. Luke were developing right away, and they needed to get the street vacation squared away. They approached me with the LID solution to get them out of having to build sidewalk improvements on Southwest 46th Avenue, instead building much lower cost improvements on Southwest 45th Avenue so they could get their street vacation done and move along with the first phase of their capital campaign and the associated improvements.
Okay, so colleagues, could I suggest this is just a first reading, so we're not taking a vote today, and I have a hard out that I'm going to extend to 12:35, which means I'm really pushing my luck here. So why don't we do this? Why don't we move this on to second reading? And if there's further discussions, they could happen this week. And then if somebody wants to bring back a change next week, that's fair game. And I'd certainly be open to that if somebody suggests.
And I'll be happy to follow up, Commissioner. If I can just make one final point, which is
if it's quick,
sanitary sewer improvements and the additional scope items that were contemplated at LID formation did not cost all that much money. So the net effect of this is what you've really had is another property owner joining the LID and helping offset some of these additional costs, which benefited St. Luke. So I think this is a very symbiotic project. Everybody's gained a lot, everybody's gained a little. And in my final analysis, I feel very comfortable that this is fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it. Commissioner Daly, is that okay with you if we move on?
That's fine. Thank you, Andrew. And colleagues, if you have any questions or concerns, feel free to contact my office. We'd like to bring it back next week, but I'm willing to extend if necessary.
Good. Sounds good. Thank you. And Andrew, thank you as always for your thorough work on this. This is a first reading, but not emergency ordinance, moves to second reading. Next item, and I believe it's going to be returned, is 665, Water Bureau.
Authorize the City of Portland on behalf of the Portland Water Bureau to acquire certain permanent and temporary property rights necessary for construction of the Willamette River Crossing Project through the exercise of the city's eminent domain authority.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to pull this back to my office.
So agreed. Next item and our last one, 655, which is pulled off the consent agenda.
Authorize a grant agreement with Work Systems, Inc. for the Summer Works Youth Employment Program within city bureaus for summer 2020 for an amount not to exceed $551,600.
Colleagues, Summer Works is a partnership with Work Systems, Inc., the City of Portland, Multnomah County, Washington County, and private businesses that work together to provide a variety of educational training and employment opportunities engaging for youth ages 16 to 24 years old. This legislation will establish a grant agreement with Work Systems, Inc. and the City of Portland for youth interns through the Summer Works program. The goal of the Summer Works program is to enhance self-reliance and employability of the youth by assisting them in the development of work and life skills. The interns have the opportunity to work alongside city employees to develop and further hone their employment skills. Over the years, the City of Portland has had a history of investing in young people through funding various programs in the areas of after-school and recreational activities, youth employment programs, creating seasonal job training, work experience, internship, and job shadowing opportunities. We have Tiffany Penson here to answer any questions. Good morning, Tiffany. We all are familiar with this program. It made it onto the consent agenda, but I think there were some follow-up questions that people might have had. And so why don't we just forego the presentation and go right to the Q&A. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I pulled it off the consent agenda because, as we all know, it's mid-August. And so the original material I got did not give me the details about what would be different with this $500,000 allocation. I have since then received lots of information about it not being a summer works program, but actually a year-long program that will allow these young people to be employed or to get support services from community social service agencies. Had I had that information in the beginning, I would not have pulled it off consent. I have it. My questions have been answered, and I'm ready to vote.
Awesome. Very good. Colleagues, anything else on this? Commissioner Udaly, your hand's up, but I think that's from last time. Very good.
That is correct.
All right. Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Tiffany Penson and Andrew McGough, thank you for being on the call all morning waiting for this. Aye.
Wheeler.
Thank you.
Yes, same, but it's always an educational experience, and I hope you at least enjoyed that. Cheaper than college. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Thank you all. We are adjourned.